Anyway, good afternoon, folks, and welcome to our technology session. Unfortunately, I have to explain something. Coordinating to have Apple here this today was, everything was in the works since August. Last Monday, I got a call from Susan Lundgren that the person that was going to be coming here had a family emergency, and the replacement person was overbooked, and somehow things got filed up. Bottom line is, we got screwed. So part of it is because of the planning that was done by the folks at in their PR department. It's a person that I've addressed the issue with the corporate communications at Apple, and they're taking care of business. So I'm sure this is not going to happen again. So anyhow, what I did is I turned to my good friend Peter Contisani, who is another Mac user like I am, and I could have done the presentation myself, but I'd rather have somebody who is a user, who is visually impaired and understands about the needs and requirements for a person with disability. So I asked him if he would speak, and he agreed to, which I'm very grateful for, because otherwise you guys would have been stuck with me, and I didn't want to do that.
Bad.
My feelings were hurt for a second, but that's okay. I got over it. Anyway, folks, no, honestly, Peter is amazing. I met Peter a long time ago, and he amazes me what he can do with the computers. I worked in aerospace as an engineer for over 25 years altogether. Have done a lot of stuff in the area of computers, and especially in the area of GPS and navigation for the military hardware. If you want somebody who understands adaptive technology, who's been around it for a long time and is extremely good at it, you can't find anybody better than Peter. So I was glad that he agreed, and I'm going to turn the microphone over to him. He's going to cover stuff which Mike from Apple was going to cover. Unfortunately, Mike's not here, so Peter will cover it. And whatever questions that Peter can't answer, I will attempt to answer. If I don't have an answer for it, by all means, send me an email at lherrera@gte.net. lherrera@gte.net. And in the subject, put an Apple question. Then I'll know who it is from and what is it regarding. And I can get you the information directly from the Apple people, because I work closely with them on various projects. I'm also a beta tester for Apple products. And I also do other kind of work for Apple as well as Microsoft. But, yes, Roger? Noel Runyon will be here from 2:30 on up. Noel Runyon will be giving us a tour of assistive technology as it's evolved over the years. Excuse me? Then and now, exactly. Yes. So for those of you guys that want to read the Great American Novel or War and Peace with a single cell braille display, you'll have a chance to do so. So that's right. And also Noel's going to read some other stuff that you guys will be interested to know, was the way that we used to function before modern technology came into existence. And by modern technology, we mean 20 years and up, because some of us have been around. I built my first computer in 1977 out of a Heath kit, and I'm sure that this guy is, and I know Roger's been around technology just as, probably longer than I have. Right, Dad? There you go. So
back in D.C.
Anyway, today, because this being the 75th anniversary of CCB, we thought that it would be ideal to have somebody like Noel Runyon, who, if you guys don't know Noel Runyon, you'll get to know Noel Runyon. He's an amazing person, and he is probably the biggest connoisseur of junk that I know of. But it's wonderful junk. It's stuff that we all worked with at one time or another, and it's stuff that paved the way to what we have today. So I look forward to it. I think it's going to be great. So
for somebody to shoot their
cool Versa Braille to it. All right. By the way, I have a Versa Braille that came in a lunchbox, the old Versa Braille that runs in a cassette. I still have one of those. It still works. And my Opticon still works. It still goes strong. The original. Yep. Ew. Anyway, okay. Having said that, folks, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Peter. So, folks, here he is, Peter Contisani, and it's Mac Tricks.
Hi, everyone. I brought a couple of things with me. I've got a MacBook Pro. I have an iPod Touch, and I have an iPhone. And it's going to be talking through a Bose sound dock, which is designed for the iPod, but it has an external plug, so you can plug in whatever you want to it. Anyhow, we're probably going to start with the iPod Touch just simply because that's what Louis said. No, it's the easier one of the three to go with. It's completely a touchscreen device with two buttons on the left side of the unit on the edge, which are volume, and a small button on the top edge, which is lock, unlock, and also the power button. Mm-hmm. And then at the bottom edge of the touchscreen, almost at the edge on a top surface, is a round button, which is known as the home button. And those are the only four physical buttons that you'll see on the unit. This unit is sealed. The battery cannot be removed. It is rechargeable lithium polymer. So it lasts for supposedly up to 30 hours of continuous playback. It'll charge from your computer through a USB cable. Whatever, it takes a couple hours to fully charge. And it comes, when you get it out of the box, it doesn't talk. If you don't have anybody around to help you, you can plug it into your computer. You use iTunes with it. iTunes will recognize it. You go to the iPod setup. You go to Universal Access. You select VoiceOver, and voila, and it talks for you. So you don't actually need anyone to help you as long as you have the tools. If you have a computer, Mac or PC, you have iTunes, you plug it in, you go to the settings, go to Universal Access, check the box that says VoiceOver, or if you're low vision, you can check the box that says large print, or Zoom it's called, and it will turn it on for you. All right, so what does it sound like? Well,
Safari,
it said. Now, I actually have this at the volume of the speed that I like, but I suppose I can go in and change it, so don't mind it for a second.
Settings.
I'm going to go in and
change. While Peter's doing that, button. I was going to say something
Safari.
Earlier.
Nike Plus iPod. Button.
Okay, I'll take it offline.
You don't want to hear me? Fine.
You want to hear it?
Okay, no, so. I was going to ask here, how many people here used an Apple IIe or an Apple II Plus?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was old.
Okay. You know what? Apple was the first company to come up with a computer that was somewhat accessible for us. And a company called Computer Race Corporation came up with some software to allow us to use that Apple computer.
Music. Button. General. Button.
Excuse me, Roger.
Select settings. Button. Password lock. Home. Data type. Keyboard. International. Accessibility. Button. Accessibility. General. White on black. White on black. Mono audio. Zoom. Off. Voice over. On. Button. Voice over. Zoom. Voice over. Voice over. To select an item. To tap. To practice voice over. Speed hints. Speed hints. Speaking. 32%. Adjust. 44. 37%.
That's way too slow.
20%.
No, not really, Peter.
No? You think that's good?
No, Peter. People have to hear.
7%.
How's that?
20%.
Yeah.
To select an item. Touch it.
Is that clear enough?
Yes.
Okay.
Accessibility. Button. Accessibility. General.
So I'm backing
button.
Out now.
General. Settings. Button. Settings. Settings.
Settings.
Plus iPod.
Settings, it said.
Home.
Okay.
Settings.
Unfortunately, what it's happened, it's going through my speaker, through a microphone, through this PA, which is, you know, not the best. But, okay, I didn't explain what I did just then. So I know where settings is on the screen. It's kind of on the bottom left, not quite the bottom, but a little higher. So after a little bit, you know these things. But if you don't know these things, there is a way to go through the items on the main screen one at a time by going from the top left all the way to the end. And these are called gestures. Now, because it's a touch screen, you have to learn how to do things completely different. So you can just touch with your finger wherever on the screen, and it'll say what's there. Once you've touched an item on the screen, it is effectively highlighted. So then you can touch twice quickly, called double tap, on a screen anywhere, and it will actually select that item. So if I touch somewhere on the screen right now...
Maps.
So I just touched maps. My hand is away from the screen. If I go back to the screen, I don't have to touch that area anymore. I can double tap anywhere, and the maps will activate. Okay? So if I double tap really quick, tap, tap...
Maps, search or address, search, text field, auto cap on.
Okay, so what I just did is I activated Maps. There, it also makes sounds that you'll get used to, which that sound you heard is sort of like the activated opening sound. Something is showing up on the screen. Also, if I hit the home button now, which is what you use to get out of an app.
Home. Maps.
And now it said Maps because that was the last thing that was highlighted on the screen before I opened Maps. Now, the very top left.
Mail.
So I can now start flicking, which is sliding my finger left to right sideways on the screen. And that will move my focus from one app to the next.
Calendar, photos, contacts, YouTube, stocks.
So contacts, YouTube, stocks.
Maps.
Maps.
Weather.
Weather.
Voice memos.
Voice memos you can record. Now,
notes.
Notes, you can type yourself a little note.
Clock.
There's your clock. You can use it for alarm. You can hear it. You can also tell it to sleep after an hour, half hour, and it'll turn off your iPod so you can go to sleep with a book or whatever.
Calculator.
There's a calculator which is interesting. It's accessible, and you can use it as a four-function calculator when it's vertical, when it's portrait mode. If you flip it sideways, you get landscape, and now you get all the scientific functions, which is kind of cool. You can do that.
Settings.
And then there's a settings where I used before to go slow down the iPod.
iTunes.
Peter?
Yes.
Are these in like X number, you know, in columns and rows?
Yeah, they are. They're 4x4. Let's see.
4x4?
What I'll do is I'll start touching.
Mail. Calendar. Photos.
Three on the top row.
Contacts.
There's actually four on the second.
Mail. YouTube.
Okay, the first one on the left on the bottom. I'm sliding my finger from left to right slowly so you can hear them all. The second row is YouTube.
Stocks. Maps. Weather.
So there's four. So that's the second row.
Calculator.
So I went down the right side, so I'm going to go back to the left.
Clock. Notes. Voice memos.
And you can, while you're moving.
Flat screen.
Absolutely.
Initially, you'd sort of know, like you would just almost on keyboard, where these little squares and
well,
the,
that's right, unless you rearrange them, in which case.
Okay.
You can do that. You can move things around, but if
you display, if I, where you leave. If there's a particular thing you use the most, you can move it to a one. Like I, for example, have relocated the weather thing right to right and get to right in the lower right hand corner. So I get to it right away.
Now, there's always at the very bottom.
Music, videos, Safari, App Store.
So there's four on the bottom. Music is the bottom left. Videos, Safari. Safari is your browser. So if this unit is connected through Wi-Fi to the internet, you can browse the internet. You can go to iTunes Store, buy music, do whatever you want to do. But you know, what's this thing for, really? It's for playing music or books or whatever. So one of the things you can do is, once you've, let's say you've selected a piece of music from anywhere, you can just take two fingers and double tap on the screen, and it'll start playing the music for you. Oh my God, it's Beethoven. And I can just stop it by doing the same thing again, double tap. Now, if I actually go into the music.
Music.
So I double tap to get in.
iPod.
Here.
Ludwig van Beethoven. Symphony No. 5 in C minor. Fade. Op. 67. Allegro. Beethoven. Symphony No. 5.
Shut up. I just double tap. I just single tap two fingers on the screen and that shuts up the voice. Now we've got a completely new screen and at the top left.
Back button.
We have a back button.
Ludwig van Beethoven.
Then there's the name.
Symphony No. 5 album tracks.
And then on the right, you have what's called
100% battery.
Shut up. Album tracks gives you a list of all the tracks on the album you're listening to. And then Playview is the opposite of that, and that gives you just the song.
Album art button.
You can always tell whether you're in one or the other. If you touch kind of the middle of the screen, it says album art. If you are in Playview, which shows you the current song, and if you have some photo or image or artwork that the album contains, it'll show that to you. Of course, we won't see that, but as a sighted person, they can see the artwork. And on the bottom, you have things like
volume, 56%, adjustable.
Now, I have the hints turned off on my iPod, but it would have said things like swipe up to increase, swipe down to decrease. That means take your finger and slide up the screen.
69%.
Or slide down the screen.
56%.
So once you've touched that control, you can then take the action of swiping up or swiping down. Now, you can also touch
previous button.
Previous button.
Play.
Button. Play button.
Album art.
Whoops.
Next.
And button. The next button. So, like I, you see, sometimes you're not always completely precise, but who cares? I mean, you know where, kind of where it is. And you can, if you hit the play button.
Play button.
You can also use the swipe motion, just left to right.
Next button.
And that will get to the next button, or.
Play. Previous.
Can you
button.
See? So there's a couple of different tricks you can use. I'm going to get back. I'm going to give you an indication of some of the other things you can do. So I'm going to go back to the backup.
127 feet back button.
Back. So we've jumped. What we've just done is taken ourselves out of the Beethoven piece, and we're now in a list.
G Town Hang, Shadow Prophets, Kevin Eubanks. Hourglass James.
I'm in a song list, so I can actually decide I want to stay in the song list and look for a song, or I can back out even further and go to an album list or artist list or playlist that I've made or whatever I want. So I can
now playing button.
So I can say go. Well, I want to go back to now playing, which was the thing I was just playing before, or I can go backwards and
table index adjustable.
Now here's the thing that I use a lot, because this, if you have thousands of songs, how are you going to get to where you need to go? There's a thing called table index on the right. When you swipe your finger down, it goes to the letters of the alphabet.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, A.
So if you know what song you're looking for and what letter it starts with, you can go there. You know, at least you cut down the list quite a bit.
I, J, selected.
Okay.
K, L, selected.
So we'll do L.
L, A, Lady. The Adventures of Panama Red, New Riders of the Purple Sage.
Okay, so do you want to play that one? Okay, let's play that one.
L, New Riders of the...
And I just double tapped with two fingers and it stopped it. But you can see, so this is how, this is the procedure you use. Once you start getting used to it, it's not that hard. It's kind of pretty easy. And, you know, if you're listening to a string of songs and you don't really like what you're listening to, you can actually shake the damn thing.
Diana Krall, Christmas Time Is Here. Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, EP.
And it shuffles it for you.
Christmas time is here.
So, and the quality of the music is outstanding. I'll just tell you some of the things you can do. We won't demonstrate everything, but you can go into settings and you can change your equalization. You can tell it to equalize all songs so they're all the same volume, so you don't get hit with a really loud song and a quiet song. You can say, I want, you know, I'm listening to a lot of rock and rolls, I want more bass or more treble, this or that. They have preset things you can do, or you can set your own equalization, or you can just turn it off, depending on the kind of speakers you're connecting to. There's just a ton of stuff you can do with it. And all the built-in stuff is accessible, even the maps to most of it. Now, can you actually feel the map lines? No, but you can look for an address and it'll show it on the map and you can tell somebody, here's how you get there. So as long as you have Wi-Fi. Now, this is because the iTouch doesn't have a phone in it. It's just an iPod. But it's identical in function to how the iPhone works.
Volume, 56%.
Okay, so
adjustable.
We'll move on to the iPhone, because now we'll add the next level, the always connected iPod with the phone.
Play button.
Okay, so we're going to...
Volume, 56.
Be quiet. Okay, so we're going to lock this down.
Home, screen locked.
So what I just did is I hit the top key on the edge, and it locked my screen. So now when I touch it, nothing happens. So we'll dump that sucker, and we'll plug in the iPhone.
Questions?
Yes, we'll take some questions now.
How are you going to find this out? What's going to speak on the program?
I'm using, right now I've got I had the headphone jack connected to the cable that I have going to my Bose iPod dock, and there's a microphone sitting in front of it so that it goes to the PA. But, you know, I could have turned up the iPod, the Bose pretty loud, and it covers this room. It would cover this room nicely, but I figured this way, it could also be recorded, which is good. All right, so now...
132.
So I'm waking up my iPhone. My iPhone is locked. I hit the button at the front. Again, it looks very similar to an iPod Touch because it has the button at the very bottom of the screen in the center. And there's two buttons on... Actually, there's one extra button. There's two buttons on the left for volume up and down. And then above that, there's a flip switch, which is for sound and vibration. So if I flip it down, the phone will vibrate in my hand briefly, and it just to tell me that now it's in vibrate mode and there will be no ringer. And Then at the top of the phone, there is the unlock power on off button.
132.
So what it does, as soon as you hit it, it tells you the time.
Unlock button, unlock settings.
So I've turned, I've unlocked my iPhone now. The screen is fully live, and the screen items are slightly different.
Edge, status bar item.
So I checked, I just touched the very top of the screen, and it gives me a status indicator and said it was Edge.
AT&T network,
edge,
status bar item.
It just means I don't have 3G in here.
Two bars.
I only have two bars of signal.
Status bar item. Camera. 95% battery power. Status bar item.
So there's another status item on the top right is the battery status.
Messages.
Okay, so here we got messages is the first item on the top left. And again, if you want, I can go.
Messages. Calendar. Photos. Camera.
Now we have a camera on this device, so that we have four items at the top, and you just heard them all.
Weather. Maps. Stocks. YouTube.
Okay, so, yeah, I heard somebody say their camera. Well, actually, I found a little program that turns this thing into a CCTV. It's only 99 cents. It doesn't work great, but it works to some extent. It really kind of depends on your vision to see if it's good enough, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you, the kind of thing, what's interesting about these devices, you can get programs that are really inexpensive that enhance the capability of the product significantly. You know, one of the first programs I bought was Weber on the Grill, and, you know, it's $5. And I just said, well, let me see if it actually works. It's not expensive. So I bought it, and it's completely accessible. It works great. It's called Weber on the Grill, and it has recipes. It has a grill guide, tells you how much you, it tells you how to set up your grill to have different heating zones. It has a timer, so you can time your grilling. It tells you, you know, let's say I have you know, two lamb chops or 3/4 inch. How long do I cook them to cook them for medium rare? And it'll tell you. And it's all accessible. Funny you should mention that. I have iBlink on. It's called iBlink Radio, and you have access to all, you know, podcasts that might be relevant to blind people that you might like. Plus, they have the radio reading services from all over the world. As far as I can tell, there's one from New Zealand, from Australia. There's ones from the United States, and you can listen to them as they are broadcasting. It's streaming through the internet. Yeah. There's also a program, and I don't have this yet, but a friend of mine has it, who's low vision, and he also uses VoiceOver, and it's called Pandora Radio. Pandora Radio essentially is like a radio station, but you make up your own song. So you tell it what you want to hear, and it'll make up a radio station, and it's free. Now, if you want to put up with a commercial every 5 or 6 songs, that's fine. If you want to pay $46, it's non-commercial. There's no commercials on it. You pay that $46 once a year, and you can get Pandora commercial free. NPR Radio has a streamer that works with the iPhone, and it's accessible, and it'll stream any radio station, NPR station, from anywhere in the country. So, what else we have
settings.
Here? We have weather.
Voice memos. Notes. Weather.
And the weather is easy.
Weather. Alameda. High 65 degrees Fahrenheit. Low 54 degrees Fahrenheit.
And then if I touch the next day.
Currently. Partly cloudy. Currently. 65 degrees. Thursday clear and sunny. High 66 degrees Fahrenheit. Low 49 degrees Fahrenheit. Friday partly cloudy. High 66 degrees Fahrenheit. Low 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
And so on. And I actually just flicked my finger to the right to go to the next day. Yeah.
Here,
yeah.
About
yes.
Is there a way that you can title them so when you're scrolling through them you know what they are? And you can hear the title, like, you know, your phone number or you can have you.
Home.
Yeah, you can.
Weather. Clock. Notes. 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 One.
I'm sorry, you said a voice notes, not notes.
Home. No, voice memos. Voice memos. VU meter. -20 VU. Image.
So it's actually telling me the VU meter right now.
Record. Button. Show recordings. Button. Show recordings. Speaker. Button. Voice memos. Done. Select 5:42 p.m. 10 seconds. 23/09. More info. Button. 0%.
More so info. We go to more info. Let's more see if we can actually change the info. Name.
542 trim memo. Share.
Now you can't do it with this, but if you bring it into your computer, you can, manipulate the file. That would be one of the things that I would say needs improvement.
Info. Voice memos. Button.
But I don't use voice memos that much.
Voice
memo.
Speaker.
But it is one of those things that you'd want to be able to name your file. That would be kind of nice.
Voice memos.
But there are other programs that do this as well as voice memos. And they range in price from $2 to $6. And I haven't tried.
These are third
parties. Voice memos is built into the phone. There's a bunch of third-party recording programs that you can get.
And some of them are more accessible than others.
Yeah, what I've tried is almost completely accessible except for one thing. You cannot rewind the damn recording back to the beginning because VoiceOver doesn't see the icon. And so I emailed them, and they said that they would be very willing to, they put me on the beta list, and they said, we want to work with VoiceOver. It's important to us, so, get on the list so then when we come up with a new version, we can make sure it does. It's a company called, Audio File Engineering, I believe, and it's a company, the name of the product is called Fire Field Recording Software. And essentially, it's the high end of recording where you plug in an external set of microphones to the bottom of the iPhone and it turns it into a professional field recorder. So if I could get that program to work well, that would be just awesome because you could do some excellent recordings. This thing's got 32 gigs of memory. You could record for hours and hours in really high quality.
Can you connect
over
record a rehearsal session for about 4 hours?
Yeah, you could.
iTunes.
Okay, so one of the other things you can do with the iPhone is actually make a phone call.
Phone. Phone. Blank phone number. Text field.
All right, so we're in a blank phone number. We got a keypad on the screen. So we're going to touch.
Six. Five.
So I'm sliding my finger left.
Four.
Remember what I said earlier, whatever you touch, that's highlighted. So if I want to generate a 4?
5, 7, 4.
Okay. I can either double tap that with my finger, or I'm going to keep my finger there because it's easier to always keep your position so you can find the next number, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to tap with a different finger. That's called split tap.
4.
So I just dial a 4. So I'm going to do 4, 6, 4.
6, 6, 5, 4, 4, 2, 2, 1. 1 1 3 3 5 5.
Okay, so what I just did is I dialed the number, and I can check and see did I dial it correctly.
1:41 p.m.
Whoops.
Phone number 464-2135. Text field.
All right, I did.
Delete button.
So I'm going to delete it now.
Delete. Delete.
Split tap is when you keep one finger on a screen and tap with another finger. And it doesn't have to be with the same hand either.
Another finger can tap it anywhere.
It doesn't matter where it taps. Yeah.
It's similar to keeping the play scroll.
I'm sorry?
Similar to holding down the control of the shift key on the keypad.
Exactly. Well, no, it's actually similar to holding a key down first and then hitting another key.
Right.
Because some people kind of hit them together. This is important that you hold one thing down first because you want to keep your finger on the position where you want to select. And this works for anything. It doesn't have to be a phone number. It could be anything you want. Like if I want to go to...
Contacts.
I want to choose contacts. I'm holding my finger on contacts. I'm going to tap with another finger.
Contacts. Selected.
So now I'm in contacts. But it's really up to you what's most comfortable.
Keypad. Button. Keypad.
For example, just right
blank
there, I touched keypad... And I just double-tapped with my finger again, because that was just convenient at that moment. It really kind of depends on where you are and what you're doing. If you're typing, with a QWERTY keyboard, let's say, for example, I'm going to go...
Contacts.
Back to contacts, and I'm going to go to search.
Elix Software Corp. 143.
So I'm going to go...
Status bar item.
Okay, I'm in the middle of my list. I need to get to the top where the search is. There's a thing called swipe up with three fingers. That shows you it goes to the top of the screen. Okay, so...
Hewlett-Packard Incorporated, Elix Software, Marillus Hicks, 1:43 p.m., status bar, Elix...
Uh-oh.
Peter Harrington, groups, button,
there we
all
go.
Contacts, Gina Harper.
Hey, there she is.
Groups, button, all contacts.
Okay, so...
Button, my number, search,
there
text field. Insertion point of Anita Aaron.
Okay, so the search box is now active. As soon as I heard search, I double tapped. And now I have a keyboard on.
Capital V, capital G.
So this is where I do the split tap. For me, that works better because then I can just move around the keyboard.
Capital F, capital D, capital S, capital A.
See, I'm moving left. And you can also do the flicking, like I mentioned earlier, flick left to right.
Capital S, capital D, capital L.
All right.
Capital L.
So I actually prefer holding my finger down, tapping.
Capital L.
So an L has been entered into the edit box. What am I going to look for? Lauren. L-A. No, L-O.
O. O. Louis Duchessen.
So I just typed two letters.
Lorraine Brown.
And I've gotten a bunch of L-O whatever.
Alameda Lock and Key Service.
And it doesn't have to be the first word. See, it could be anything. Lock. L-O, right?
Clear text. Button. Lorraine Brown. Lauren Cope. Helen Dornbosch. Louis Duchessen. Logitech Incorporated.
It's actually Logitech, not Logitech.
Merle Long. Audrey Lord Hussman.
Anyway, so let's say I wanted to pick one of these guys.
Jesse Lawrence.
Or
Louis Lucero. Marriott Long Beach.
So Marriott Long Beach. L-O for Long Beach. I opened that up. Now we've got a contact information.
U. I. O. I.
Wait a minute.
Sir, empty list. U.
It didn't open it. What
space
happened?
Empty list.
I don't know why I didn't open it.
Two bars. Signal. Search. Log. Text field. Clear text. Button. Clear text. Search. Text. Able. Abstract Research and Development Court.
Okay.
Abstract Research and
Development
Court.
We'll open this one because I don't know what happened to that other one.
AC Transit Information.
Want to do that one?
Yeah.
Okay.
AC Trans. All contacts.
Okay.
Button.
Oh, I know. I was one of the things to think about when you're using the phone is holding it in a position where it knows where it's either portrait or landscape. If you hold it sideways, kind of a little bit, what happens is it'll switch to landscape, and then you get disoriented because you're saying, "Where's everything? Everything's upside down." So that's what was happening to me.
Info. Edit. But image.
Okay, so the first thing we got info, which is what we're getting, then edit if you want to change it, and then there's an image in case you're putting a picture in there.
AC transit information. Other. 510-839-2882.
That used to be the direct line to getting, what still is actually, you can use it to get information on the buses.
Ringtone. Default. But text. Message. Button.
So you can text message.
Share.
You can share with somebody.
Button. Add to favorites button.
You can add it to your favorites list so that you can get it quickly.
Favorites button. Recents.
And then
button.
We go back and we flick. Kept flicking right, but now we're at the bottom of the screen where you have those. There are basically
favorites button. Recents.
Contacts, keypad, and voicemail.
Voicemail.
They're always there, regardless of which mode you're in. You always have those five buttons at the bottom, along with whatever you're doing your other, you know, when I open my contacts.
All contacts.
I still have those four buttons on, five buttons at the bottom.
All contacts.
So I just backed out of my contact I just opened, and now I'm going to go back.
Voicemail.
I'll
button.
Show you voicemail real quick because that's
greeting.
A
button.
In voicemail, you don't actually dial a voicemail number. It's called visual voicemail. You see your voicemail right here. And you can listen to it, and you can delete it, and you can undelete it.
Deleted messages. Voicemail position, non-percent, adjustable.
So you can scroll through the voice if you stop your voicemail in the middle.
Call back, dim.
And you can
button.
Use that callback button.
Delete, dim.
Or you
button.
Can delete it for sure.
Favorites, button.
And you can hear it when it says delete, dimmed.
Delete, dim, button.
It means it's not available right now because you haven't selected anything.
Speaker, button, delete.
Well, the voicemail is not in the phone. It's connecting directly to the voicemail server somewhere, and you're listening to it from there. It's not, the voicemail is not stored in the phone, but it's controlled through the phone in a visual way, as opposed to, you know, hit 3 to delete, hit 7 to whatever. Yeah, it needs to be set up differently. When you get the iPhone, they set you up differently than you would be set up if you get another phone from, say, AT&T. I'm going to stop and I'm going to ask, see if anybody has any questions.
Home.
Lots of them, right?
Phone.
Okay.
I do.
What's that?
Yeah. Do you have
Do I have what? No, you can go to your favorite Apple store. And I'm not an Apple salesperson.
Oh. Okay.
And it has voiceover in it?
It's built in. Doesn't cost any extra.
Oh, and how much does the phone cost?
The phones range in price from $199. I'm sorry, $299 and $399. No, I got it wrong. No, that's the iPod. The phone is $199 for the 16 gig, $299 for 32 gig phone. There is no screen reader charge, and I want to make a point. We've already had two updates to this iPhone, and I've paid nothing. And I've had it since June. There's been a major update, 3.0 to 3.1. It fixed a bunch of bugs with VoiceOver, and it fixed some things with the actual phone software. And there was a minor update, it was a security update from 3.1 to 3.1.2, and there's been no charge. And VoiceOver just keeps getting better along with everything else. There's no charge. You don't have to pay extra for it.
Remember, folks, because the VoiceOver is built into the operating system, the chance of it hanging up your phone or your iTouch or your computer is minimal because Apple has very strict guidelines in the development process of this software. So when you get your iTouch, you get your iPhone, or you get your Mac, and you're using VoiceOver, the possibility of it causing a problem is very minimal. And like Peter says, all your upgrades are free because at the same time that the whole world is getting the updates for your iPhone, so are you.
Okay, another area to talk about is the interface between the phone and your computer. How do you get stuff into it? How do you get stuff out of it? When I first set it up, I wanted my email on it. I wanted some music. I didn't want it all on there. I wanted books. Usually I carry my audiobooks on there. And I definitely wanted to get all my contacts in there. Okay, so first step was to make sure everything was set up in my computer. Once I've got plugged the phone in, set it up, it automatically sent my email settings and my contacts and all the things that I've chosen into the phone. And it literally did it on its own. I didn't have to do anything to it. When I picked up my phone after that, I could get email on my phone. You have Wi-Fi. You have Bluetooth. You have the high-speed internet using 3G. You have GPS. I have been playing with a program called Navigon, which is fully accessible. And it's a GPS program that costs $90. Unfortunately, there's a couple of functions that it doesn't do, which we want, which is what's the current street I'm on. But it shows you on the map. Now, if you are traveling, it tells you what you're going to do next. Like, for example, if it says turn left on Main Street, at the bottom of the screen, you'll see Main Street. As soon as you make that turn, Main Street goes away, and then you see the next street you're going to turn on. So as long as you know what street you were going to be turning on to, you should know what street you're on. It suspends GPS. You pick up your phone call, and then when you come back, it comes back. It also. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You mean when it goes, no, not that I know of. I don't believe that there's a voice command for redial. No.
There's a redial button.
No, it's actually in the... Yeah, you got to go to the recents. And then touch the... that would be nice to have a redial button right on the bottom along with the rest of the stuff. Because then you don't have to go to recents. You just say, dial the last number I dialed. No, if your voice, you're trying to access a voicemail, if you make a mistake, the voicemail that you're calling into has to have a way of you canceling, hit the star key or something. Because the back button on the phone isn't going to help you working with a voicemail system that's not, that doesn't have that capability.
The old.
Yes. Yeah, but those touch tones are being entered as you type them. Really? What voicemail is that?
I'll show you. At this point, I can't get the backup, so I just want to give you a
Oh, I let, show it to me because I'm not quite. I don't quite understand what you mean, because when I get into my home voicemail, I have to type in my code, but those digits get generated immediately, and if I don't get it right, then I hit the star key to back out and tell the voicemail system that I didn't mean that and I want to do it again. All right, so.
Page 1 of 3.
Okay, I'm going to... One of the things about... What was I talking about? Yes. Oh, yeah, GPS. Okay, so... you know, when you start buying applications, there are so many different... You can't fit them all on one screen, so you can have up to 11 screens on this phone.
That will, page 2 of 3.
So I just switched to page 2, and on page 2 I've got AtBat2009, which is the baseball streaming program. Of course, right now there's no games anymore, but it works really well.
Mail. 33 new items. NFB Newsletter registered. Sign online main menu.
Okay, and I have the... this is just a link that I saved to the NFB Newsline online.
AtBat2009. NY Times.
And the New York Times is a nice little reader, and it works really well, because it essentially what it does is it comes and pulls up the New York Times for you. And it's a web, kind of like
NY
a web.
NY Times. Refresh. Button. Empty list.
So right now, I'm not getting any signal good enough for it to work, unfortunately.
Empty list. Empty list. Popular. Button.
I'll just choose popular. See if I get anything.
Popular. Refresh. Button. Empty list.
It might be just too slow in here.
Network connection in progress. Status bar
it's
item.
Slow. Because it's edge. Well, we'll skip that. Never mind. That's not going to work too good.
NY Times. PC.
Okay, here's another great little application. It's called Pocket Cocktails. And it'll tell you how to make your favorite little drink. And again, it's I think I paid $1.99 for this one. And it's reason. Yes, $1.99.
Public radio.
Now, we're not talking big money here. I mean, everything is really cheap. And, in fact, a lot of people are buying it. That's why it's really cheap.
Google.
And very accessible.
Next Bus Mini HTML site.
Now, this is just another link. Next Bus, where you can go and check and see where your real next bus is going to come. So if you're waiting for the 63 and it's been 10 minutes, you say, well, where is it? And you can go to the website and you can actually tell it, I'm looking for the 63. I'm at such and such a stop. When is the next one? And that's because you have this connectivity. That's why you can do this. I know one of the downsides of getting an iPhone is AT&T is going to make you pay money for a data plan. But because you have the data plan, you might as well take advantage of it and do things like check for a bus and
e-reader.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit before
page 1 of 3.
It's too late.
Messages. One.
I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the programs that don't work but almost work. Because, for example, the Kindle book reader works. I mean, you can manipulate it. You can go to the book. You can do things, you know, go to the pages and so on. But you cannot read the material. You cannot read the book. So I think we need to put pressure on, you know.
You know, the thing we need to put pressure on. NLS has made very clear that they are never going to let their service be used on Apple devices.
Oh, why is that?
Well, why does NLS ever even ask that? The thing is, we need to have a resolution that, you know, that they pay through the circuitry because they can have a key just the way they have a key now, but, you know, we're forced to buy the proprietary devices to be the NLS.
90% battery power.
And apparently, they have made it very clear on their bar discussion. I was just thinking about this on the Mac users list just this week.
Yeah.
So it's something we really need to demand. They'll have to always buy Victor's and reports and stuff like that.
I agree. I mean, there's no reason to exclude a platform. You know.
Especially as long as you have a key to log in, something like that. Login
window, authentication window, password, secure edit text has keyboard focus.
I'm so sorry, that was so loud.
You are currently on a text field. To enter text in this field, type. This is a secure text field. Text typed into this field will not be displayed.
Okay. I didn't mean to startle you like that. What we're going to talk about next is the voiceover on the Mac, just a little bit. But before I leave the iPhone, you know, I have seen lots of little applications like that work almost. And it's, you know, hopefully, because it's only been a few months that this has been available, you know, companies that make programs and individuals that develop these things will start writing for the accessibility tools that are in the iPhone now and write their apps correctly. There's nothing worse than seeing a bunch of buttons that say button, info, and it doesn't tell you what they are. Stitcher's like that right now, and Stitcher's a nice little app that pulls down podcasts, be very nice to be able to, and it's free, you know. So it's, and I think, you know, those of you who, you know, maybe adopting an iPhone or an iPod Touch, you know, be diligent about emailing these companies because they're pretty responsive. I mean, they sell lots of these things, and they're also giving them stuff away so that they can sell you something else. And if you're not happy, they won't sell you anything. So they,
you know, also Apple is very responsive. You know, if you write to apple.com/focus.
You want to do accessibility@apple.com. So if you have an accessibility concern, call. They do. But if it's a third-party app, though, they won't be the ones. And so, yeah. Now, there is another, now for those people who are going to school, there's an e-text reader, and it's designed to read textbooks. And it's almost accessible. Again, I can get to the page. I can't read the damn text. And they're right in Redwood City, for those of you in the Bay Area, and we could certainly, you know, talk to them and say, you know, we want to go to school too, you know. Okay, so VoiceOver on the Mac. Again, you know, it cost me $29 to upgrade my machine from Leopard to Snow Leopard, and by doing that, I got a faster operating system, a smaller operating system. I gained about 8 gigabytes of space on my hard drive, and I got a bunch of new VoiceOver stuff, all for $29. I didn't pay $200 for SMA or, you know, and get a new version of some screen reader which has new bugs. You know, I got now VoiceOver run can use scripts. You can write scripts for it, so you can do it, have it do things it doesn't do. It has a way for you to create hotkeys for applications that you use a lot, like email and calendar and Safari, so you can bring up the VoiceOver hotkey commander and start up these things right there.
Also, of course, one of the things that I like about Snow Leopard, if you have a Braille, a note taker of some kind, and you want to use that as your Braille display, it is very good at supporting all that. So if you're using like a Braille sensor or a Braille node, and or you have even a thing called Packmate from the company that is charging for drivers, it's supported. I mean, you plug it in, you don't have to do anything. VoiceOver sees it, and before you know it, you have a Braille display that's functional. You don't even have to reboot or nothing.
There's a little noise that it makes when it's recognized it, and then you're on and live. One of the things also is VoiceOver has a very nice speaking voice. Now, you have lots of voices. Some of them are very strange. But Alex has got a great voice, and he even breathes for you after a sentence. So I'm going to type in my password, and when I type my password, it doesn't tell you the password, but it tells you that you are in a secure field, and you'll hear a special click.
Login failed.
Whoops. Oh, I had to wake up.
Back button. Press back. Table. No selection. Interact. Peter, stop interacting with sleep button, restart button, shut down, reach, Mac OS 10 image, Apple logo image, app, Peter Kentisani's computer, table, one row selected, column, 1 of 1, Peter Kentisani, restart button, press, table, one row selected, column.
And Apple has a nice sound when you restart it. I want you to hear the whole login thing when it happens, because it's pretty, I mean, it's easy if you don't let it go to sleep first. So it takes about 20 seconds or so for it to come up.
Login window, authentication window, password, secure edit text has keyboard focus.
Yeah, it sounds like an old typewriter, doesn't it?
Welcome to Snow Leopard Mac OS 10. 6. VoiceOver is running. Finder. Desktop. Macintosh HD. Volume.
Okay, Julie, what did you have to... You have something?
Sorry, I interrupted this. I just bought a Mac after, you know, 20 years of being a frustrated PC user, and so I'm really an enthusiastic new user. And everything is... I'm just saying to you, let me know, when you come up for your next computer, you should really think about the Mac. Everything is so much easier. For instance, last night for the first time I got any sequence instructions, I backed up my hard drive. And I've always found backing up my hard drive so tedious. And this is just so easy. And almost everything is the menus for
Okay, so some of the new things that we... first of all, I want to make sure that I don't run over too much.
Yeah, Pete, we'll teach you.
Okay, we've got about 20 minutes. Anyway, VoiceOver now has all kinds of extra stuff in Safari, which is the browser, which could have been arguably the weakest area of its interface at the time. There is, on the Mac, same thing as on the PC, a taskbar called the Dock. But unlike the PC, until Windows 7, the Dock on the Mac lets you launch applications, and you can park them there, and you can see what's running. On the Windows side, until Windows 7, you can only see applications that were running inside the taskbar. Now in the Windows 7 taskbar, you can actually park applications as well, so they've kind of put it all together. So the Mac has a special menu, just like Windows has the system menu. The special menu has all the things that are utilities, like your Wi-Fi, your Bluetooth, your battery meter, that kind of stuff. And you also have your main menu. And the Apple always has a main menu at the top of the screen, even on the desktop. So if I go to the menu right now, hey, wake up.
Menu bar, Apple.
So you probably turn it up a little bit. Okay.
Finder, File, Edit, View, Go, Window, Help.
Okay.
Help.
And then you hear the sound, you hit the right edge of the window.
Yeah. Help, Window, Go, Edit, Apple.
Now, it also has other sounds. The Mac, you can turn them off, by the way, because a lot of people may not like them. But I like some of these indicators, these sound indicators that tell you things that are happening.
Apple menu, 11 items.
So one of the new things they've done is now they tell you how many items in the menu that you've just opened. It didn't used to do that. And also you've got verbosity settings. You can go into the VoiceOver and tell it, I don't want to hear all this junk.
About this Mac. Software update, Ellipsis. Mac OS 10 software, Ellipsis.
Now, the way it deals with things like dot, 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 it says Ellipsis. It doesn't say dot, dot, dot.
System preferences, Ellipsis.
Okay, so I'm just going to kind of walk you through a little bit of Safari stuff.
Closing menu, Macintosh HD volume.
Hopefully we'll have Wi-Fi in here. Let's see. We can double check that.
Menu bar, Apple, Sync menu, Time, Universal Access, Bluetooth menu, 404 bars with LeapNetworks.net,
yes,
Macintosh HD.
We've got access. Good. So I'm going to go to the dock now. I'm going to press Control F3. That moves the Mac to the dock.
Mac, dock. Finder, running, left paren 1 of 27, right paren.
And then I'm going to hit S for Safari.
Safari, left paren 4 of 27, right paren.
And at this point, I can either hit the VoiceOver command to start it or the Enter key. I'll use the VoiceOver command, which is Control Option, which is VoiceOver keys, and then spacebar.
Finder, desktop, Macintosh, Safari, window, Nominatrix, HTML content.
So we're going
to... Page has 16 headers, 92 links, 18 auto web spots, one form control, list 7 items, Apple, Store, Mac.
Okay, I'm going to stop it. Did you hear that beep?
Yeah.
That's a link. Now, I would say link, but I prefer having it go beep. So it doesn't get in the way of the speech. So there's no reason to have extra words. That's right. It's actually controlled in the sounds. Yeah.
Apple.
Now, did you hear that? That means you went to the next item.
Store, Mac, iPod plus iTunes, iPhone, downloads.
Now, you heard about auto web spots, right? I can go to the first one of those and see what it thinks it's important.
The new iMac, the ultimate all dash in dash one, now with the ultimate display.
So what it does is it kind of takes a link with a bunch of text around it and says, that's probably pretty important. So it makes a web spot out of it.
Heading to Apple Online Store. Questions, advice, 1-800.
Did you hear him breathe? Questions, advice? That's funny.
Questions, advice, 1-800-my-apple. Send feedback. Provide some feedback via online form. Heading level 2, hot news headlines.
Now, there's another thing that they've done which is kind of interesting. It's called a web rotor. And a web rotor allows you to pick what you want to see when you're moving with the VoiceOver stuff. So if I do web rotor.
Open web item rotor, headers, 16 items.
So right now I can go just to the headers if I write to right arrow.
Links, 92 items.
So I can decide I want to just navigate links.
Auto web spots, 18 items.
And I can navigate just the auto web spot. So I'll go to that first.
Apple Link, the new iMac, the Apple Online Store, Quartz, in new Logic Express 9, a tremendous value for musicians, heading level 3.
Okay, let's say I want to know about that. I hit enter, and there we are.
Logic Express 9, a tremendous value for musicians.
And then I can continue reading from there by hitting, I can continue reading from that spot by just hitting the...
Heading level 3, Logic Express 9, a tremendous value for musicians. October 23, 2009. Comparing the new Logic Express to other digital audio workstation apps, reviewer Christopher Ellipsis. Learn more, head level 3, Apple.
And I shut it up. Now, one of the nice things about hitting the control key, and it shuts up right away, but if you say, wait a minute, I didn't want to shut it up yet.
Unveils new iMac with two 1.5 and 2.7-inch displays. October 20, 2009.
So it remembers, it keeps that information still in the buffer. So if you hit the control key again, it continues reading from where you shut it up. Until you do another command, that buffer still stays there and you can continue reading it.
9. Apple today unveiled an all-new iMac line featuring brilliant LED.
So I stopped it again, and I can hit the control key, and I'm going to resume it reading again.
Dash backlit 2.1.5 and 2.7-inch widescreen ellipses. Learn more. View all. View.
Isn't that great? I love that feature. Because sometimes you hit it and you say, well, maybe I want to hear a little more. Okay, so the other nice thing about the Mac is it's the ease of way you can move from one app to the next app.
Finder, Finder, Desktop.
Okay, Safari's still running.
Doc, Safari, running, left turn 4 of 20.
Okay, it'll tell you. And we'll do iTunes.
iTunes, left turn, iTunes, Finder, Desktop.
And iTunes will run now. And...
Finder, Safari, iTunes. Vista.hd, iTunes, sources, table, one row selected. Column left paren, one of one right paren, iTunes store.
Okay, the way iTunes works on the Mac, well, it's supposed to work the same as it is on the PC, but on the PC side, it just doesn't seem to be quite accessible, as accessible yet.
Close button.
So,
minimize button. Zoom button. iTunes.
So, one of the concepts or the way you deal with the voiceover in the Mac is by interacting with objects, and that's the thing that you need to get before you really get used to using voiceover.
Previous. Play. Next. Mute button. 80.0% volume slider.
Okay, so this is a slider. For example, this is a volume. If I want to actually change the slider, I need to interact with it.
Interact with slider. 90.0%, 80.0%, 70.0%.
You see, so I'm changing it now. If I'm happy with it, I can stop interacting with it.
Stop interacting with slider. Full volume, but Apple logo, MDL, text list view, grip, sources, table, one row selected.
So,
column left paren, one to one right paren.
Let's choose music.
Ringtones. Library, music, library, playlist.
Okay, so...
Vertical splitter, playlist, browser. Interact with playlist, a cappella. Left paren 2 of 28, right paren. Alternative in punk, left paren 3 of blues, left paren 4 of 28, right...
So let's say I choose blues.
Stop interacting with playlist, browser.
See, I was interacting with it. I didn't say it because I just wanted to get it done.
Songs, table.
So now I've got a song. Now I can actually interact with the song list.
Blank, name, Jacko Diamonds. Hangman's Blues. Atlanta Strut.
So let's say I want to play that one. Anyway, so you can see how I interact with the table, and then when I'm done with it, I can just quit.
Stop interacting with song. New playlist button.
And then you've got buttons on the side.
No repeat show artwork button. 9-7 items. 6:15:52 total time. 7-6.2 megabytes.
Now, this is the thing. Whatever you pick, if you pick like a couple albums and you make them into a playlist, and once that playlist is highlighted, then you'll see this thing that tells you how much time and how many songs and how many megabytes it uses up. So if you want to transfer it to your iPod, you know how much room it's going to take up.
Genius. Dim button. Show Genius sidebar button. Show Genius sidebar.
See that little button?
Show
we're
Genius.
At the bottom of the list.
Show Genius. New playlist. Previous button.
Okay, so.
iTunes.
Okay, so I'm going to go down.
LCD section. 9-7 items. 6 LCD section. Text LCD section. Full
I'm
volume.
Gonna, I'm going to move to store. I want to show.
Sources,
real quick.
Vertical splitter. Playlist. Browse. Vertical splitter. Sources. Table.
Okay, so we're going to choose sources and we're going to go to the store now.
Move. Audiobooks. Library. Click application. Ringtones. Radio. iTunes store.
Now you heard a bloop. That means the store is now active. It's got a little web area. And we'll go there.
Vertical splitter. Previous iTunes. Movies. Menu. TV shows. Button.
They've added a bunch of things which I'm not sure I'm so happy about. It just kind of crowds the area, but I guess it makes it easier for some people. You've got the button for movies, button for music, button for this.
App store menu. Podcasts. Audiobooks. iTunes U. Menu. Button. PETER. Menu. Button. HTML content.
Okay, here we are. We interact with it.
Interact with HTML content. DJ.CZGLC. Heading to music. See all. Michael Jackson's This Is Left Paren, the music that inspired the movie Right Paren, Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson's This Is It Left list two items. Michael Jackson's This Is It Left Parent, the music that inspired the movie Right Parent. Clickable.
Now, there's a lot of duplication here because they put the link, and the link is labeled. Then you've got the image, and that's labeled. Then you've got the list with text in it. And it's like, you know, at some point, accessibility is being overdone.
Michael Jackson.
I think.
Click. End of list. Michael Jackson's Fearless Left Parent Platinum Edition Right Parent. Taylor Swift.
Okay, so that's, you know, basically if I picked one of these albums, it would bring up a table that has the songs that I could actually sample and so on. But you can see how I can navigate this thing pretty easily, right?
Save me, send for... Soul Book Ross Stewart. Heading level 2, music. Heading level 2, movies. Heading level 2, TV shows.
This is exactly what you would do with Jaws, right? You would move through headings like that by hitting H.
Heading level 2, Halloween music.
Or you hit L for link.
See all. Keeping Halloween Alive - single, Alice Cooper.
There you go. All right, any questions?
Yes, here.
Go ahead.
Have you used spreadsheets?
Yeah, I have. Not so many, though, because I don't really have... I haven't had a need for it, but Numbers is the program you need for that on the Mac. And the whole package of Numbers, Pages, and the presentation program, the whole package is called iWorks. It's $80 and is now fully accessible.
Yep.
It's a really nice little word processor, too.
And the beauty of it is that you can take an Excel document, a spreadsheet or something, and work on it. You'll never know that you did it on the Mac because it'll support the format across.
Well,
so if you're using Pages and you want to work on a Microsoft document, doc file, you can go ahead, make the changes, call the backup, send it back to the person. They'll never know you did it on the Mac.
I actually sent Louis a document last night that I did in Pages, and he probably thought I did it in Word.
Yeah. But I knew because he said that he had created it with Pages. So
yeah, I did actually tell him.
And actually, the formatting was pretty good.
Yeah, so it's pretty good. I mean, the fact that it's only $80 instead of several hundred for Office. One quick thing. Any other questions?
Quit iTunes, Finder, Desktop. Safari, Window, Apple-Start, Finder, Desktop.
So I just quit both of those programs with a Command Q.
Now, one of the things is, all these applications that Peter is using are all right off the shelf when he buys the computer. None of this is extra. Safari, iTunes, VoiceOver, and all the stuff that he's been doing comes directly out of the box. So you don't have to worry about going to, you know, get your Apple computer and go broke and all the other extra software because it's all right there.
October 29th, 2:22 p.m. Keyboard commander off.
Yeah, they've added a couple of keyboard commanders, so I really like them. I want to talk about email is one of the things that people like, you know, really need to do a lot. And iChat. The email program on the Mac is very good. It works just pretty much flawlessly. I've never had a problem with any, you know, it did some weird things at first when I set it up because I didn't know what I was doing, and I added a couple extra email addresses, inboxes, and I just got rid of them.
Doc, iTunes, so, left turn 7 of 27, right turn, mail, left turn 3 of 20, finder, desktop.
Okay, so I'm in mail, real
mail,
quick.
Window, inbox, Gmail, left turn 60, messages, right turn, messages, table, no selection, has keyboard focus, one row added.
So what you just heard is two emails came in as it was getting them, and it said one row added. So I mean, actually, they put you in the table of messages, whatever in mailbox you left. When you left it, it brings you back to that mailbox again, because I have four different mailboxes.
Interact body blank from Amazon.com. Subject, Amazon Kindle : now with U.S. and international wireless, only $2.59.
Okay, so I got this email from things.
Stop interacting.
I wanted to actually read the email.
Messages. Message content. Scroll. Interact. Text. New line. Amazon.com. Image. Free 2-day shipping with Amazon Prime. A1.gif. Image. Kindle Store. Your Amazon.com. Shop all departments. A2.gif. Image. A3.gif. Image. New line. Amazon Kindle now with international wireless image. New line.
So I just read the whole email for you, but you can actually...
Message content.
Remember I said you can interact with it? If you interact with it, it'll read it line by line. If you just let it go on its merry way, then it'll read it all.
Horizontal messages, table.
And then I can just delete it.
Unread image, blank. Audible subscriptions, NYT10-.
I'll get rid of that one, too.
Blank. Steve Matsuri.
Okay.
Vertical mailboxes, table, RL into Soap, Sandero Group, Alameda Net, mailbox, 3.
So anyway, and you can see, you know, it's once you get used to this, it's just as easy as using Outlook. Any other questions?
Quit mail, finder, desktop.
Yeah.
it's compatibility with Atlas. And you're talking about compatibility with Word.io on the
Well, you, if somebody sent you an email, you won't know, you know, where it came from anyway. If you want to transfer your email from Outlook, there are tools to do that. I didn't do it that way, but I actually did all the stuff. I synchronized. Okay, here's what I did. I synchronized my Nokia phone with my Windows side. Then I synchronized my Nokia phone with my Mac side, and then I synchronized my Mac side with my iPhone.
You can import your PSD files. If you have a PSD file that you backed up from your Outlook, or you have an Exchange folder.
Yeah, there are tools to do that.
You can import it into your Mac. I've done that regularly. I've done it just most recently. Last week, I had to import my PSD file onto my Mac.
Okay, well, when you tell Outlook to back up your mail, it creates what's called a post office file, a PSD file, and it has everything. It has your contacts, your calendar, your emails, everything in it. It's a big, big file. And then you take that and you bring it into the Mac side. And it shrinks. And it also brings, I mean, it'll bring all the stuff that you had, and you'll have all those folders in the same arrangement that you had before.
Yep.
Peter? Yes.
Something we haven't mentioned yet. If you just have to have certain applications, remember the Mac can run. You have to buy a program, but
you
Mac can run your PC stuff. I have
on
Windows.
Sync menu.
Hang on.
Three items. Finder. Desktop. Vista.
Well, you can run it under virtualized window.
I actually have the VM.
Yeah, VMware.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Menu bar. Apple. Apple. Software update. Ellipsis. Mac OS 10. System preferences.
I'll tell you. I'll leave right after I do this.
Window. Show all button. Leave in toolbar. Time machine. Startup disk button. Press startup disk button.
This is the way I do it. I run Windows.
Leaving scroll area. Mac OS 10. Windows on Vista HD. Press Windows on Vista HD button. Restart Ellipsis. Press reinteract with alert dialog. Are you sure you want to restart? Restart. Press.
Okay, the Mac is already shut down, and it's now restarting. It's so fast on the Mac side. Now, it's going to, you know, have to put up with a little patience because the Windows takes forever. So what I've just done is I told the machine to restart in Windows. So the machine starts up as a Windows computer completely. And, of course, I only gave Windows 32 gigs. The Mac side has more, but... But Windows doesn't need that much because it's not like I don't use it that much anyway.
You can use there's many things you can do. There's many ways. Bootcamp, of course, comes with your Mac, but you can also buy such things as a program called Fusion.
Yeah.
If you want to run concurrent operating systems on your Mac and you have enough memory to support it, minimum of four gigabytes of memory, then you can have both Windows and Mac and switch back and forth. And I do that all the time. And you're right. I use Windows because JAWS just seems to eat it every time. And or Dolphin. I can use Dolphin or Windows. I prefer Windows because there's no such thing as issues with the, what do you call that dreadful thing? Authorization keys.
Right.
So it makes it real clean and real powerful.
JAWS for Windows is ready.
And I can switch back and forth. And in my job working with people that use multiple platforms, I can switch back and forth and only carry one computer.
Password edit.
Okay, so here we are. You've heard JAWS talking.
Embarrassing.
Yeah.
I have plugged up 10 into the USB port on my computer to get my Supernode to work. How is it working on this operating system?
I'm sorry.
I think it's Supernova, right?
Supernova is a speech magnifier braille.
Supernova's got everything. It does the same thing the VoiceOver does. It gives you the screen reader, the magnification, and of course braille support.
Okay, well I'm totally fine, but I use the screen reader for you, but I
You can't use it on a phone. It's on a this is a computer network.
This is the laptop we're talking about now. This is the MacBook.
Are you synced with the computer?
No, this is the actual computer itself running.
We switched from the iPhone to the MacBook Pro because we covered three items. We covered the iPod Touch, the iPhone, and VoiceOver on the Mac.
I have a question.
Yeah.
This sure sounds great, but I never put my hands on an Apple computer, and I got a screen every time I operated Windows. I imagine the transition from a Windows platform to this is getting harder.
No, it's really not, because the hardest thing is to learn to remember. If you're going to use this machine as a Windows machine, number one, you have to remember that the Windows key is by the space bar and not between the Alt and the Control key. That's the biggest problem. Everything else is, first of all, the Mac side is always consistent. You know, you're always going to get a menu at the top, and you're always going to get the dock. You can, even if the application that you are running may not be responsive, you can back out of it. You can go to the
menu. Windows is ready.
It finally is up and running. Anyway, you can force an application to quit. It doesn't. You never lose your speech. That's, you know, I can't emphasize that enough. It's like on the Windows side, there are times when you spend 30 seconds and a minute or longer without any speech, and you don't know what's going on because there's not enough resources to make the damn thing talk. You never lose speech on the Mac side. If an application such as iTunes, you know, maybe you asked it to do some mammoth thing and it's taking forever and it keeps saying, iTunes busy. Well, you can back out of it. You can Command Tab. You go to the menu, you go to Force Quit, and tell it to force it to quit. And it's there are tutorials. I would say if there is a weak area, that's where Apple's weak area is for VoiceOver, is the tutorials. There's not enough of them. There's Mac Visionaries, run by blind folks. It's a list serve.
On the list, it's one of the list serves. And the one I've been using is MacVoiceOver.com. And that'll answer a lot of other stuff, too. And the website is very helpful. If you want to just check out and say, well, what's around? Because that's what I did before I bought. The website is called ICanWorkThisThing.com. And they have all kinds of stuff there. Go check that website out. I read a lot before I made the switch, because I, like you, was terrified. I thought, I'll never learn this thing.
It's great. I love it. It's dedicated to VoiceOver and the Mac. And there's also JoshTheLionCourt.com. He's got some interesting stuff. Plus, you know, once you get involved in these things, there's a lot of people that have been doing this thing for a long time, and some people have been using the Mac with the Outspoken for years, you know. But it's become quite a lot easier now. I mean, you know, is there stuff that could be better? Sure, there's always stuff that could be better, but I think it's getting there. It's getting close to being
this.
We're pretty much at the end of our time now. Anybody else have any? Okay, here's the good news. You go to a Mac store, you buy a MacBook, $9.99, and includes VoiceOver. You buy a MacBook Pro, $13.99, $14.99, $15.99, $2,000, and it includes VoiceOver. You buy an iMac, includes VoiceOver. $11.99, $14.99, $17.99, and 99 cents. And then you can buy the Big Daddy, there's a Mac Pro, whatever. Yeah, with the multiple bays, you know, like a big server type unit. That's $3,000, $27. But, you know, most people don't buy that unless you're gaming or doing weird video stuff.
Are you setting up a server?
The Mac Mini is $600 for the very basic, $9.99 for the fully powered. No, and that's a lot of power for that price. I mean, the Mini now has a one version. I think it has a half a terabyte or 1 terabyte of memory. It's ridiculous. It's of gig storage, not memory. Yeah. But memory is 2 gigs, 4 gigs, depending on what you want to spend. Now that the Snow Leopard is fully 64-bit, and then the Mac Windows 7, if you're going to do a split boot, that can do 64-bit as well. So
for those of you that don't know what a Mac Mini is, if you have an APH digital player, your digital player is bigger than the Mac Mini.
That Mini is so small. If it's a purse almost, and it's a desktop. Yeah, you attach your keyboard and your monitor, and it's got a DVD player recorder in it.
Yep.
And now it's got 2 hard drives.
That's right.
It's nuts.
Anyway, folks.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you, Peter. Peter, I'm going to ask you if you can do me a favor.
Yeah.
If possible, if we can get you to pretty put together a list of some of the websites that people can go to obtain information on Macintosh. Perhaps we can get you with the BC to have it published so that those that are interested can know or sure. have it. So because it's a great resource.
Yeah.
And believe me, folks, I've been working with Macintosh. Well, I've been supporting Macs since 1985. So, and except I'm one of the weird breeds that uses the Opticon to read whatever speech won't work. But however, been involved with Apple since they got really interested in wanting to come up with an accessible operating system that would speak. So Tiger was it. And what Apple has done in 4 years supersedes what Microsoft hasn't done in 25 years.
If you guys want to talk more about it, I'm actually supporting, I'm representing Sendero this week. I'm at the Sendero GPS booth. So if you want to stop by, talk Mac, talk iPhone, talk GPS, talk anything. I will be at the Sendero booth.
In the exhibits. Okay. Now, so thank you, Peter. And, well, what else can we say?
No. I don't.
Okay. Our next presenter is here. Do you guys want a quick break or do you want to go right into it? Right on. Okay, good, good. Okay. This presenter is an interesting individual who is the only guy that can turn my cup of coffee into a sponge and expect me to drink my sponge, I mean my coffee. If there's anybody who's been around technology a lot longer than I have, there's two people that I can look at. Roger Peterson and Noel Runyon. Noel Runyon is kind of an interesting individual. He brought today some of the most unusual pieces of equipment that will give you an idea where technology came from, what was it then, and what is it now, and hopefully he'll tell us where, in his opinion, things are going. So, folks, I want you to give a welcome to Noel Runyon and all his arsenal of gadgets. And the brains behind the operation is here, his wife, Debbie, whom I don't know how she's going to put up with all this stuff because, I mean, she helped him bring all this stuff in, and I guess he has to pack it all up and take it back home. So, and some of the stuff here, folks, I tell you, oh, my goodness. I got my hand on a cube board that I haven't touched in 32 years. My goodness.
I know, I'm kidding.
Oh, they're fighting for a chair here, Peter and Noel Runyon. Anyway, folks, I hope you guys enjoy and appreciate where technology is. But this is a treat for me because some of this stuff I have at home, some of the things I've read about and never had a chance to even play with them. But the most important thing is that we get to hear about how it got here. So I'll turn it over to Father Time. I mean, Noel Runyon. Okay, Noel, take it away.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. Thank you. I have only two qualifications for being here. One is that I'm probably older than most of the other people here that have been in technology, so they figured I had to soak up something that I could give back. The other is I have an extremely patient wife. Not only put up with me today in dragging all this stuff here, but that she puts up with a large amount of the garage being taken over by, I call it stuff, she calls it junk. But she's put up with this interest of mine in all kinds of antique technologies. Now, I don't claim to have the best exhibit of everything. If we were... Thank you. If, you know, there are other people like Bill Gary who could go back way further back than I can in memory and in stuff. You know, but I brought some representative examples of things that I think are kind of different. We did drag a whole Prius full of stuff here today of different kinds of things. Yes. But I'd like to start by asking you all to use your imagination a little bit first. Since we're talking about the Louis Braille Bicentennial, if we all step back 200 years ago, I don't know how many of you are back there then, but let's try to imagine. Just Roger. Well, try to imagine, if you can, what kind of access we had back then. We, huh? Oh, well. Most of the access was through dependence on a living person, sometimes animal. But typically an old guy or person that would lose their eyesight would try to find some bright young little kid that they could hire to do all the things like running, you know, the household and dragging them around places and telling them what time it was or anything like that. Over the years, though, the access did start to pick up. And I went through and did a little history and timeline study of some things to try to put some of these in perspective. And I'm going to try to go through most of this kind of chronologically as they were developed. And I will dart off with various different things if I can find them, where we put them here. So one of the trends that you may see through this access history from a couple of hundred years ago is that things started off sort of first with dependence on others, and then the tools of access became essentially mostly just manual. And for many years, they were based on manual. Then some of them started becoming electric, meaning powered by electricity. Later, we got into things that were more electronic. They might have tubes or transistors or things in them. And then the digital, as we got into integrated circuitry, microprocessors. And then today, most of the new advancements we're seeing, as you just got through seeing from a truly interesting presentation by Peter, is through software. And with software, you can take a little bit of hardware and add a whole lot of software function to things. So those are trends that we can hopefully kind of see as we go through some of these things. I'm trying to read Braille that got. I had to whip it out on a machine that was going kind of sick on me. And not all of my technology works right. So I'm going to be trying to talk about, sort of based on the dates a little bit, but the first thing I want to point out is a couple hundred years ago, we were just before the start of the Victorian period, and that was when Queen Victoria, oh, got it right already, that she was interested in various areas of helping the blind, and she actually did commission having a typewriter developed to help some niece or somebody to be able that was blind to be able to write letters. Well, now as you guys all know that there was tactile reading and Braille weren't available yet back then, and the story starts really more like in the 1780s when probably Louis Braille's dad was just being born, when they were starting to work with finding a way to help blind people read, and they were looking at large print. How could they emboss paper, make large print, some way of doing tactile reading? Because it was considered that if you're going to really teach the blind, you needed this basic technology to be able to do things. Give them information in books, allow them to read and write notes and stuff. So there were several efforts at trying to make writing machines for the blind, and they did eventually end up in typewriter. Another writing project was the ballpoint pen. They were trying to figure out how to lay down a thicky and goopy kind of even line of raised plastic or something that would dry up and make raised line letters. Well, the ballpoint was supposed to do that. It didn't work very well for that, but it sure worked well for laying down pigment in ink and turned into the ballpoint pen success of Lindy fame and all that worked well for sighted folks. So now we did see, this is another trend I'm going to talk about. There's a number of technologies that were really developed specifically for people with disabilities, and in our case, talking about visual disabilities, like text-to-speech systems. Now, yes, the regular markets had some interest in it, but people like Kurzweil and others that were really looking at making things talk found that the area that really had a driving need and some money for development was in the blindness field. So text-to-speech really got its kick and start from an impetus and research from working on products for us. Also, optical character recognition, particularly Kurzweil's stuff. He couldn't get funding for something that would read very poorly and do a lousy job of converting print for the regular business market. But he certainly got an interested market for blind folks. And eventually, as you now know, it's used heavily by businesses. Similarly, we went through similar kinds of things for speech recognition. And we ended up with various different things that generically we call curb cuts, things that maybe can help, designed to help somebody ostensibly with a disability, but then you find a lot of different things. Like in case of curb cuts, you start seeing women with baby carriages and people delivering stuff, you know, on a hand truck full of curtains or something like that, not just people in wheelchairs. Roger?
There's a baby in the bed with
baby carriages. Yeah. I put a baby in there, I think. But in any case, and thanks for keeping me politically correct. We had also things like, say, the color, talking color ID. You know, it's something that isn't that, you know, specific, only blind people. Now, a lot of people are fine. They're sitting across the room on a couch and the phone rings. Are they going to get up and go answer it? Sure, it's nice when they don't have to because color ID can just tell them, oh, forget that. You know, so, that old boyfriend, you know, the guy, he can just sit on the couch and ignore the boyfriend. So the expense, yeah. Now, in general, this field was, yeah, sorry, this field, do I have to sit next to him? This field was helping to fund a lot of special products like that, and you can see that as generally a theme throughout a lot of this. So who knows what things are being specially developed for us today that may end up really helping everybody in the future. Another thing, there's a couple of other things to keep in mind when I'm going through this history, I'm going to whiz through some of these, demonstrate a few of them, but I'm going to encourage everybody to come up and fondle freely of the equipment. I mean, afterwards. And I knew Roger was here, so I had to say that. One of the other themes that you can see if you're watching Access Technology develop is repetition of invention. And this is one of the sad crimes that just really breaks my heart to see people reinventing something that somebody else has already put a lot of work in and developed for us, but it hasn't been, for whatever reason, published to the point where somebody else could discover it. How many people in this room have personally experienced the invention of, say, a light probe?
Yes.
When somebody from AFB did some research on that, he was talking at a conference saying, I have traced down the development of 40 different light probes. Somebody in the audience raised his hand and said, 41? And I rose both hands, 42, 43. So there, it is something that's simple and has been redeveloped many different times. In fact, those of you who know Bill Gary knew that his dad was blind, and a friend of his dad's actually developed the first light probe. That it didn't have transistors in it, didn't have vacuum tubes in it. It was made with a neon light bulb, what's called a relaxation oscillator, capacitor, resistor, and neon light bulb. You hook an earphone or speaker and battery up to it, and it runs. Add a photo sensor like cadmium sulfide to get tacky, and it can work. I think that there's a possibility, I haven't seen anybody do this, but there's actually a possibility there may be an even older light probe that came before the photosensors. Because neon light bulbs, if they're the old type, can actually sense light. And you can use it actually as a sensor. So if anybody has run into somebody that invented the oldest light probe, I'd sure like to know. People have also invented dark probes. that can tell you where print is on materials, things like that. There's one that was used in voting systems for paper ballots. Now, something Bill Gary would really talk about if he was here is the sense that not only are the gadgets neat and stuff and important, and the invention and development of them and the manufacturing and all that, but a very important thing is having the whole infrastructure of support that goes around with it, the rehab engineering that goes along with teaching people to use these things, developing training materials and all. As an example, when I was working at TSI and we were first putting out the VersaBraille as a serial product and all, you had to hook these up with a serial cable to other equipment, and it took a special little cable adapter called a null modem. And since I was working in tech support, we got so many orders for null modems. People thought we're the same thing, but they, you know, little cable adapters. But people didn't even have an ASCII table at the time. So we had to develop all of that support around there to give people that. The Opticon, those of you who ever learned to use an Opticon know that it's not just something you sit down and start using. You have to really do speed building, those kinds of things. So I'm going to jump through some of these things now, and if I don't get too tangled up in microphones and things, I'll run around where we can show you the gadgets. Okay, so we had said that around, you know, the early 1800s, 1808, was when things started to move here. There was a system for tactile night reading that was used to let military people, the idea was it's the little dots and bars on leather to let them read at night. You know, they wouldn't have to turn on a light where somebody would spot them or whatever. And plus, they didn't have electric lights, so no flashlights. The lanterns were nasty, so they had to read at night. Well, it wasn't very successful. It was like 12 dots and dashes. It was really complicated. And so the frustrated inventor took it to the blind center that was just popped up. They're just starting to have these blind centers. And there's a guy named Louis Braille. Have we all heard this story? Okay. Louis Braille looks at it and says, this is too complicated. And he does up a code with just 6 dots. His dad did a lot of leather work, so he had the tools to be able to punch out just Braille dots. And Louis Braille, who was, we did say he was, born around that time of 1809. Night code was done in 1808. But as what we found was that they were still working on trying to develop other reading codes. Everybody remembers the War of the Dots and stuff. And actually, before Louis Braille actually did his Braille code in 1827, somebody did some of the first raised line books. There was actually an English book that was done in full glory in raised text. And they thought that that was the way to go. How many of you guys have all tried to read print dymo, raised dymo print?
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine trying to read a whole book like that? Gag. That'd be bad. Yeah. Around that time, they finally got a successful writing machine for the blind, patented in the United States 1829 for actually a typewriter. So things are starting to change. We're getting the technologies for people to be able to start to read tactily and getting ways that they could write with handwriting guides and with typewriters. So in 1829, Louis came up with his code, and it took him about 5 more years to perfect it in 1834, come up with a real code. Now, I kind of centered on the fact that a bunch of things started happening around that time in the 1830s kind of time frame. That, Roger? We'll get there. Yeah, yes, sir. Thank you. There is the New English... The New England Asylum. See, Roger is just a perfect fall guy for me to segue. There, what happened in 1829, the New England Asylum for the Blind, Roger, was formed. Roger?
Yes.
Which started up what later became Perkins. That's right.
It's by the husband of the lady who wrote the Battle of the Republic.
Ah, okay, good. How? Very carefully, yes. Okay, but I thought it was kind of interesting that they were referring to them as asylums. Today we think of asylums as mostly insane asylums, but they're generally a place of respite. But that was what a lot of the centers for the blind were just a place to put them, protect them. It's bigger than a closet, so it was kind of nice, you know. But it was an awful lot of the blind folks back then were closeted. So if I can read my notes here, give me one second to figure out what the heck is going on. Well, I'm going to try to bump on here. 1830s, though, many different schools for the blind started up around the world. And we had and Perkins started up the Howe Press. I wonder why. Where'd that name Howe come from? And but keep in mind, this was 100 years before the Braille Code was really adapted here and accepted. So we had about that 100 years war in there where we didn't do too well. In fact, in 1847, there was Moontype was introduced. And there was the Boston Line Type introduced in 1852. And they came up with all of these different codes that, you know, didn't settle down in a big hurry on what code they were going to use for almost 100 years. I mean, especially in the U.S. So in 1868, they came up with yet another one, the New England line type. Did anybody ever see that? It's sort of variable length Braille line, you know, where characters varied in their length. Think about trying to make an embosser to do that.
Oh, wow.
You know, is that kind of tricky?
New York Point.
New York Point, yes, thanks. And I'm skipping some of this who accepted what when and stuff like that I think is pretty trivial. But a very interesting development was in 1871 was the stereotype. Everybody knows what that is? Basically a machine for stamping, usually Braille, in zinc plates. You can take these zinc plates, sort of folded zinc plate, and slip a piece of paper between them, run the mess through a couple of rollers, like your old clothes wringer. Nobody remembers that. But the rollers squish it, and it forms Braille. And you can...
My grandmother's Braille machine.
Mm, yes, good. They're a major problem to get your hair in, right? my little brother was trying to tell me that's how you cut your hair, was put it in here and I'll crank it. but we didn't... I'm back in here. We had the Boston type, the line type from Boston that they pushed for a long time. What I'm trying to fill is for having lost my place here. Did anybody ever say I was a fast Braille reader? Roger, you didn't accuse me of that, did you? Okay. The stereotoner, that allowed you to press Braille out, though, pretty rapidly. And it sure beat the slate and stylus for being able to produce something. So it really meant you could start to make books with whatever Braille code you were using, if it was something in Boston paper. So around 1876, which was 100 years after this country was born, we had telephone was invented. And people don't talk about that very much as an access tool, but it certainly has always been what I consider a very good, accessible access tool for us to give us all sorts of information. A little more important relevance thing that most people would agree to, although they were both telephone, was useful, and so was Edison's cylinder phonograph in 1877. His cylinder phonograph started with foil, tin foil, actual real tin, not aluminum, wrapped around a drum. And it scratched a groove in it. And in his patent, he actually mentioned making recording materials for the blind. So Edison was thinking about us even then. Yeah, what a guy. Yeah. Now, that's right. And he really pushed for the education of blind, by the way. Right? Pardon? In about 1880, what was the significance that happened around that time? Helen Keller was born, and Ann Sullivan entered the Perkins School, right, as a teacher. And that's all we need to say about her because it went on. There was a... her first... this didn't come out right. It looked like Helen Keller again. Hall, somebody named Hall, made the first personal Braille writer. So instead of using this big, huge press thing, you could actually have something with keys on it. You could pump the keys. Right? The Hall Brailler. You had one? It worked? Yeah? Yeah? Well, it really got people off of having to use the Braille slate. And transcribers were much more willing to produce books in their home and all if they had something they could just sit down and kind of punch away or type on that wasn't a stylus.
I learned how to use one here.
Uh-huh. Now, we're finally up to around 1918. Around 1918, we're nearing the end of the First World War and the end of what other major war? The War of the Dots. That effectively, the War was of the Dots was winding down, that APH finally accepted using the English Braille standard. And it took them a while longer before they accepted grade 2 Braille in this country. But around 1820, there was a very interesting piece of technology that went nowhere, which was the optophone. Anybody guess what the optophone is? That if I said it sounds like the opticon? Yeah, exactly. It had seven tones for a little vertical slit it looked at on the line, a vertical line. And you scan that along the page like you would an opticon, but instead of vibrating a single column in the opticon, you got seven different tones spread over, an octave and a half, something like that. You may have heard later about something called the visitoner and stereotoner. It was the early model of that. And Bill Gary and I debated about whether it was tube, vacuum tube driven, because it was before transistors in at that time, 1920. And we agreed it could have been possibly, again, neon oscillators, neon tube oscillators with cadmium sulfide photocells. Or
I think they even had, they didn't have a circuit that had a spinning wheel that was just interrupting the light.
Ah, I didn't know that. Yeah, that would simplify the circuitry to some. Then.
Parking lot already been used, still around as far as I know. They keep their users of that.
Okay. In 1927, there was what happened, Roger? The LP record was patented. And that was one more thing that was actually a little more realistic than Edison cylinders. That now I have here. I'll just point it out over at this end for those of you who can see. We actually have a vinyl record cutter, a dictaphone kind of machine that would scratch records the same way as Edison's original records in a vinyl disc, though. They did also make them in vinyl belts, but it's just a plastic disc, like you're about the size of an old 45 record disc. Yeah, very thin and flexible. You slap it on there and start dictating, and it cuts the record for you. Then you can go back and tell it to play without cutting. So, you did. Well, come up afterwards, and you'll be able to see one. So, yeah, yeah. Well, you might be nostalgic. You know what I say? So,
that's where I learned the idea of all rubber. Because my teacher, We had an old rubber. Yeah.
Okay. That in our time chronology, we're not there yet. But okay, you're doing good. Okay. An interesting thing is around 1928. Some of the player piano manufacturers actually modified the player pianos to play music on the hour and on the half hours. So they were actually musical clock player pianos. Yeah. Well, I don't happen to have one with me today. Sorry. Talk to Bill Gary about it. Let's see. Who knows when the first talking clock was at all?
My talking clock was at
1980. Okay. Now, some of you may know. It's okay. You got some power. Your chef?
Really?
You did? You're trying to break it down. Okay. Can we get the microphone this far down here?
This way.
It's you can take it anywhere.
Thank you. Now, it could have been. Some of you might have said that the
9:55
AM. Might have said the sharp talking time.
On Dell Minus come sharp products.
No, I was asking a general question yet. One was the first one. So it was not that one. That was about 1979, I think.
Yeah. 79, 80.
Thank you. The. Yeah. Well, the. Holly, please, Holly. Now, I also have up here a Sharp EL620.
I want one of those.
I've got a 640 too. Well, now it wasn't either of those. What it was, if I can find the speaker on this thing.
Oh yeah, Panasonic. I can count. Yes.
Let's see. Now what it is a clock radio and Panasonic made.
11.
Yeah. Time isn't right. Inside it has a magnetic disc, and it spins the disc, and it steps across the disc and plays the proper track for the time on that. And it does that over and over. This was from about 1971, 1972, when the first ones came out. And Bill Gary says you can't repair them. So he hasn't been able to anyway. But it's a nice AM, FM clock radio. But, it was also remotely triggerable. It's made by Panasonic. So that's in the fondle table up here. Okay. Now, I guess these microphones don't interfere much with each other, right?
No.
Okay. So let's. So some of those things were actually up in the, you know, further up the time. I skipped up time a little bit here, but generally we're talking, say, that in the 1930s, the early times, the Depression periods. It turned out there were quite a few developments back then. I moved away from the mic. I'm sorry. Is this better? Okay. In the 1930s, the Depression years, there were quite a few things happened. One is FDR actually signed funding for developing a talking book machine that AFB developed, and long-playing record books were first distributed by LOC, and we got the actual starting of that whole Library of Congress recorded book stuff going. Okay, so then when is that a question back there? Okay, the especially if I'm not near enough the mic, just yell, please. So 1930s, we saw the a number of different things like that that were developed in the talking book area. And in the 1934s, we had the first talking books come out. And then in 1935, what happened? Roger? Did Roger run away? No, wait, we'll skip it. Well, in 1939, we had what was called if I can read it right, it's called the Visigraph. It was an actual attempt to make embossed pictures and all that from a machine, embossed braille and all, on tinfoil or aluminum foil. It was done up in Canada. It actually electrically drove tinfoil, made little bumps in it. And Bill Gary's friend, a Canadian up there, said, "It cut my fingers." He said it with a Canadian accent, though. But it was so sharp on the ends of the things that it could actually cut your fingers, so where it burst dots and stuff like that. So that was the Visigraph. But it was moving in the direction of trying to make some of these, something that could allow you to do reading. Now, very significantly, I think, for technology development, in 1941 through 1944, there was a mystery, which was? Before the war. But the mystery was, why were all these premature babies going blind? 1944, they finally came up with, that's because they have RLF. And people said, yeah, what's that caused by? Well, we don't know. I think, very significant because the fact that RLF the hyperoxygen issues left people usually blind, but with most of their other capabilities intact. So they didn't have, as was typical of scarlet fever and syphilis and other diseases that the fringe people got, they didn't have a lot of other mental retardation and deafness and stuff. So it was mostly just a single handicap. It was also something that was an equal opportunity disorder that got to the rich as well as the poor. And I think that that's what was very significant for technology, was that it was the parents of those children, as they grew up, were expecting a lot more of the kids and not going to just put them in a closet. They really wanted to mainstream those kids, and they wanted the tools and all to help them do that. And so it really seems to have been a very important part of starting those tools getting developed so kids could go to college. In high school, they could learn math and things like that. And so some of the it's interesting because it wasn't until 1954, 9 years later, that they actually figured out what it was that was causing it, the hyperoxygen. So we had a whole group of folks back there that fed this field, and many of us are retirement age. I wasn't an RLF, but many of us are in retirement age now. So that's changing the whole makeup. But some of the tools they started developing were things like the 1952, K&E, one of the big slide rule companies, made a braille slide rule. And there was a later one done by APH. We have it up here. A circular slide rule. Debbie, you want to just point some of these things out? Hold them up so those who can see could see them. It was made out of an LP record.
A 10-inch diameter LP record and with two pointers on it. Do, 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 do. You have to spin it real fast to hear that. But it may, if you followed along the length around the circumference, that was a pretty big long slide rule. You know, you have about almost a yard or so of material there. So back in those days, the way engineers were rated was how big it was meant their slide rule. And if you had a foot-long slide rule, you had a hot one, whereas if you just had a little 8-inch slide rule, that wasn't very impressive or accurate. Excuse me. Another thing that was happening in the 50s there was Tom Ritter joined the staff of AFB, and he started doing all kinds of things like this, the K&E kind of slide rule, and lots of tools like rulers with Braille on them, all kinds of equipment. Talking clocks, things like that. So they really played a major part in doing that. We said 1954 was when they finally figured out what was causing the RLF problem. Then in 1957, something you've probably mostly you've experienced is thermoform came along. You know, not according to my records. It was and I don't know why I skipped it, but 1947 was the Perkins Brailler. I was jumping. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they didn't change it until like last year. You know, it was almost 60 years. And when I was back there,
Abraham did a good job.
Abraham did a good job, but they said if it's not broke,
don't fix it.
Don't try to fix it. So they stuck with it, and it had a lot of problems in it. But they've improved a few of them for sure to make it better. So that is talking about the Perkins manual brailler that replaced the Hall brailler pretty much. But it's the standard workhorse of the personal brailing industry. And also transcribers in schools and such. Now, a little bit later, 1957, there was the visitoner and visitactor. Now, we mentioned before the audible slit of tones. The visitoner was revisiting the same concept. Visitactor did the same thing with vibrating. So you'd have seven or so pins, and it was sort of like an opticon missing five of its columns. Yeah. Or where you've got some kind of weird finger damage. I don't know. But it just gave a vibrating vertical column. And, pardon? Yeah, tape on your finger. Yeah, that did go for a ways. It was surprising they had. Malk Labs was building the things, and Harvey Lauer at Heinz did a whole lot of work with it. And they later improved it and to something called the stereotoner, which involved between-the-ears sounds that improved it, made it easier to hear what the letters were. And by the way, Harvey Lauer was always convinced that the real problem with it was that it didn't have as good a camera as the Opticon had. They joined forces with the TSI and the Opticon, put the tactile Opticon and the stereotoner together, they'd had a better product of things. Debbie, you probably can't find it right at this moment, but the abacus. I put in a Cramer abacus as another math tool. Good for you. Now,
let's see.
Thanks. Well, this was actually, those of you who know the Cranmer Brailler and the real history of it know that it's technically a soroban, which is one bead on the top, four on the bottom. But the soroban came from the sanpan, which was a Chinese abacus that had two on the top, five on the bottom. And what Tim did was take the basic soroban simplicity and put felt pad behind it so the beads would stay where they're supposed to. And they didn't jiggle as soon as you're trying to use them. I got one of these. That was in 1960. I got one of those in 64 for going through school. I was so glad I had the thing, okay? And I wasn't real fast with it, but I found that even when I got better calculating capabilities in my head and all, I would still use this when I was doing binary arithmetic. I just used the top row, which is called the heaven row, instead of the water or earth rows. So now they.
Fred Gassoni wrote the book.
Yes, Fred Gassoni wrote the book, he said. Yeah, another great mind in his head. No, it's Fred's head. I didn't mean that. It didn't come out right. Okay, let's move on. 1964 to 1965 was significant for what reasons this country was infected in several ways. One was by those long-haired guys from Liverpool invaded the U.S., the Beatles, 1964, and the Ed Sullivan Show. Ed was never the same. It was, but he had him on. And, pardon?
British invasion.
The British invasion. Another thing invaded was the German measles. And that had a little more serious consequences, German measles. Yeah. German
measles.
Yeah, German measles. Tactile braille, he says over here. Okay. Skin braille. Yes, sorry. Stop that. Well, now, measles were more serious because they caused, as well as blindness in babies, they also caused deafness. So you ended up with multiple handicaps from it. Yes? Yeah, you had it? Yeah. I would say something else, but we'll go on. So we're talking about 1961 now. No, are we? Yes. Well, I jumped back. I skipped one. I apologize. That was the... that was when the LP record slide rule actually came out from APH. The first one was K&E, which was really hard to use because they used rivets for the marks. And this one, the APH, was much more usable. Well, you had to understand Braille a little bit, but more importantly, you had to be able to feel those dots very carefully. Yeah, it was a pretty good log table compared to carrying around a binder full of Braille, which I ended up having to do for the trig tables and log tables and stuff. It was an improvement. So jumping back up to 1965, we had the Sonic Guide. Debbie, want to show the Sonic Guide? We have that here. Sonic Guide was the old K ultrasonic glasses. You want to put those on, Debbie? They're a real fashion statement. If it didn't scare people away and you wanted to keep them scared away, you'd tell them it was putting out X-rays. And, boy, they back off like a bad case of halitosis.
So,
yeah.
Skip the audio.
Yeah. So, Sonic Guide. That was Sonic Guide. It put out an ultrasonic beam, and I tried like crazy to find a battery for it. I almost built one, but I got too short of time. It's a special 12-volt battery. But it put out a sound like or so the different kind of sounds depending on whether you're looking at carpet or a hard wall. And what I found is you could be walking along and listen to this thing and smack right into a wall because you're so busy trying to listen to this thing and it was so complex. So what I decided was it was a lot better for using at nighttime when I could move around slowly, prowl the neighborhood, and check out trees and things. I do that at night because then people aren't coming out and saying, "Are you lost?" You know, so it's a good. Somebody keyed it as it's for improving your enhanced improvement of your environmental awareness.
Wow.
Let you know where things are more sort of. Yeah, it could if you use it too much. Maybe you lose your mind too. I'm not sure, but they did actually play with putting one on the baby to see if baby developed not the glasses but the transducers. By the way, for those who don't know, you'll see later it's got big ugly transducers right in the middle of the bridge, and it looks cyclopsy, I guess, doesn't it? Is that what you'd say?
Those are the piezoelectric speakers.
Yeah, they're or horns or something like that. Yeah. Okay. The it was something that was useful for some people, I did actually get arrested almost got arrested as a Peking Tom one time because of exploring around at night like that. Somebody turned in a Peking Tom report, and well,
security came to the windows again.
Yeah. Well, this policeman pulled me over, and he started giving me a hard time about it, and he's going, "How do I get out of this?" Just then, another policeman pulled over and said, "Oh, I know him. He's that blind guy." So thank heavens. Okay, so now we're in 1960s kind of time. Another jump back here that's out of place was when did computers start using Braille translation? 1960. And it was IBM worked with APH to do a Braille translation program for them to run on their presses. It wasn't for running your little embosser at home or anything like that, but it ran on the presses. And that was the real first use in this country, and according to Sullivan, evidently anywhere. But we'll get to that quite a bit later. And by 1965 or earlier, they were actually using it for production at APH, not just a curiosity or anything. Now, one of the reasons why it only worked with press Braille was we didn't have any little personal embossers. The first ones were in 1968 were paper tape embossers, where people took old teletype paper tape punches and modified them to not quite punch through the paper, but just to Braille. And no, that's later. Thanks. We have one up here, by the way. Of course. Thanks for asking. But what they did was take the paper tape, make it produce Braille, and so you could hook that up to whatever information source. I actually worked on field testing and engineering feedback for the one developed at AEB, I think, by Knox. There were two others, Guy Carboneau and somebody in Arizona named Morrison. So there were three paper tape embossers, and Carboneau did make products out of those. The others didn't end up products. But I tell you, it was such a mess with this paper tape spilling out. There was no take up, and it just pour out on the floor. And you want to go back, and you have to unknot the stuff and find out. And I made the mistake of babysitting a crawling baby at the time when I had to use a bunch of that. And he had a great time in it. I couldn't back up and reread any of it. So it was a difficult technology at best to use. Now, it was just before the 1960, we were talking 1968 here. 1969 was MIT Emboss. MIT had a project under George Dalrymple and working with MITRE Group, the MIT Research. I'm sorry? Yeah, okay. They were developing up Braille capabilities there. And they made this big, kludgy thing like a size of a refrigerator almost that would set up Braille and crunch it down. They made, I think, 20 of those prototypes. And they were the MIT Braille Emboss, as it was called. Anybody remember one?
Yes. Yeah. I remember Terry Davey telling me that she got a couple of fires.
Oh. Well, we'll come back to that one in a minute, or what was left of it. So this is brings us 1969 when Janinski at Rand and some others said, hey, why can't we take a closed circuit TV and hook it right up to the camera right up to a TV, put a reverse video switch on it to black on white on black, and a nice big magnifier lens. And in 1970, they came out with a product, the first CCTVs, which were pretty significant, right, for a lot of folks. 1970. The 1970 saw another device. And here, you'll see we're right now in devices that were what I call the electronic, not electrical. That was, they maybe had transistors in them, but they weren't really into digital circuits a whole lot and integrated circuits. So 1970 was the MOAT, which was a little handheld, flashlight-sized device that vibrated as an ultrasonic beam was reflected back. $600, something like that? It was a pathfinder that you held in your hand and pointed an ultrasonic beam, invisible beam, out at something. It bounced back like a bat signal and caused the unit to vibrate in your hand, depending on how far away it was. Yeah, so it's sort of bat sonar, but it was tactile and didn't make noise out very much. What happened in 1971? Very good, Roger. Said Opticon. Bliss and Linville, Stanford guys, then SRI, developed up the Opticon reading machine, a little camera, 6 wide, 24 high, made an image that fit on the palate of your finger and was magnified to read print.
Bliss got his PhD out of the lab in Boston.
Ah. I didn't realize that. But teamed up with Lindell, the department head at Stanford, and they did something different. And before this, we'd mentioned how, they developed schools for the blind, and some of the places like Perkins started developing products and Braille slates and things, and they finally had to set up Howe Press to take care of manufacturing those things for them. But mostly, manufacturing of these accessible products was by nonprofit agencies doing them. And there was a real mentality at the time, they just couldn't make a profit on it. It was just not only not practical, but it was unethical to make a profit. And to get funding for this, Bliss and Linville had to go to their board and convince them that they could make a reasonable profit of, say, not more than 10% and really make a business model out of it. And so they're the first company to really set up that model. So in addition to inventing the Opticon, I think they really invented this new model for technology delivery in this country. Now, it was kind of interesting because in the years I was there from 78 to 82, they never made a profit. So people that are beating them up for being a for-profit company, honestly, they never made much profit that I knew of. At least the profit sharing never helped me out. They were started around $3,300.
Jackie said she started at TSI The top gun was $5,000, and so was a Mercedes.
Interesting. And there weren't Mercedes in the parking lot. I guess Bliss did have a Ferrari or something. But yeah. Well, okay, now what happened in 1972? My cue from over here, by IBM in San Diego, manufactured the Banks Brailer. You got it. Thank you. Okay. Banks. It wasn't for Banks, Monetary Banks. A guy named Banks at IBM talked him into making this product. We have one here, Debbie. If the lovely Debbie will show that around, please. You don't have to wear it. It has paper tape inside of it. Nice little spool. It's very compact. It will fit in a coat pocket. It's about 4 inches wide and about 6 long.
It's paper and term papers.
I tried to make, when my Perkins was broken one time, to do a major writing with this thing. What I found was I had to set up a pegboard, and I'd do a line or so in Braille, wrap it up, curl it up, stick it on a peg, and this whole board full of little coils of this thing. I don't know if there's enough tape in there for you to write another term paper, but go ahead. Yeah, it'll be watched.
It's a cool brailer, though.
Okay.
Do you still
buy tape in those things? Probably not. Not for that use. You could pull tape off of something else, I think. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you probably could. It's just like anybody who's interested and really needs IBM punch cards, I've got blank punch cards. They were great for making notes. I bought boxes of them, actually. Yeah, well, let me know. I'll give you a bunch. You know, a box?
If you want. Just a brown one because there's a card reader with my pickup, the dot zeros.
No. What? Oh, if you had pre-punched dots? Yeah. Okay. Oops. Okay. Now, here we've reached 1972 was when that Panasonic talking clock down there came out. I didn't mention it. It not only can be set to do hourly, it will automatically talk on the hour. So some radio stations bought them because of FCC regulations. You have to announce every hour. So the thing would, bounce right in and automatically announce the time every hour. The So 1973, we're up at the... at that time, I joined IBM. That wasn't part of the history, but out of college where I'd been working on various different things, what I found that as a student, just to get through electrical engineering, I had to develop a lot of my own products, my own voltmeter and punch card reader and stuff. And so I ended up just naturally developing a lot of products, at which time Debbie runs over and picks up a Steubing card reader. Not stupid, Steubing. Steubing card reader, it's something, if you've seen a slide rule, it's like sort of a wide metal slide rule with a slide that slides back and forth over the punch card.
And, credit card register thing.
Yeah, it's about that size, a credit card embosser.
Yeah.
What it does is allows you to put the card in there, slide the slide to the click stops across the columns, and then you take a Braille stylus and run it up and down and feel the holes. When you're on the right holes, then you can figure out, okay, that's there were 12 punches, by the way, possible. So you had to say 12 and a one punch. That's the letter A. For those of you who are complaining about the problems of having learned Braille, try learning the 12-punch binary code for Holarith. It wasn't fun. So I got to work on developing up actual my own Braille card reader that had a Braille cell, and it actually, in some very early IC electronics, did a full translation of Braille. But because of that, when I went to work for IBM, I wasn't supposed to be working on blindness products, but I first jumped in, and they put me on actually credit card fraud. How to bust the BART system. They wanted free tickets, and since they developed the BART ticketing system. And so I actually got to work as a crook, which actually came in handy knowing the security of systems, how to break security on systems when I was asked to evaluate the voting machines for the Secretary of State. And it was just interesting because they couldn't tell me whether a voting system hack worked or not. They weren't allowed to tell me that. But if they came back and asked more questions, I had a good clue that they were. But one of the security problems we found, I used my ham radio and found out that things were broadcasting. One of the systems was broadcasting at 6.7 megahertz, your audio ballot, which those were not real good things. But that was all part of my upbringing with picking locks and skulking around neighborhoods at night. Trying to make a living, you know, whatever. Yeah. IBM, though, as soon as I came on board, they said, oh, we've got this project we want to borrow you part-time on. And instead of working on the centralized message retrieval table, what you call voicemail these days, all the time, I had to spend part of my time on the non-visual display technology project, which came, the impetus was somebody in Holland said, well, IBM should make a Braille display. And they said, okay, what is it going to take? So they came to our advanced system development labs and gave us a grant for a short project and said, put everybody in on it that's any good and work on it. And they said, oh, we're getting all right. Yeah, well, all right, you can put him on there anyway. And so immediately they said, we need a full CRT display. How are we going to do that? Oh, how about six little pins, and pushed up by solenoids on one cell, and we'll just multiplex it all over. Just like the BrailleMate. W's cube for BrailleMate. Happen to have a BrailleMate. That's a single-cell Braille display. The theory was you could use it to edit. It was down on the left, right to the left of the... The theory was you could edit with it and stuff, check the last thing out, and that was sort of okay. But when they started pushing it for reading, it was terribly slow.
This is cool.
Also known as single-cell anemia.
Yeah. FrailleMate, anyway. It kind of worked for that. Its biggest problems were the memory cards didn't stay installed properly. The memory cards could default on you and kill it. Anyway, IBM folks bugged me. They said, well, why can't we just take six solenoids and one Braille cell and multiplex it all over the whole screen and we're done? I said, it doesn't work. They said, and thankfully they bugged me and said, why doesn't it work? So we started this project out to really find out why it didn't work. And we came up with things like the touch-sensitive tablet for touch audio, and we developed text-to-speech system, the first text-to-speech system that could ever fit in a shoebox and later in a microprocessor. We didn't call it text-to-speech then. We called it phonetically sounding your way through the line. Because we were a little more timid, because it would say, it was very literal about all these silent letters. Mary had a little lamb. Yeah. So we did finally add a final E rule so we wouldn't say litla and stuff. But it was amazingly fast compared to Braille and stuff. You could whiz through stuff. So we got real excited about audio. And they said, well, but we also have to work on Braille. So we did some of the first Braille night and all displays for making Braille. Probably the first, but I hate to use the term first.
I like the model number of this thing.
Yeah?
Damn, DM.
DM. Sorry. Yeah, well, okay. The you guys knew he was going to be up here. You invited me anyway. So IBM did a really big project out of this that they kept pretty darn quiet. And quiet, why? Because when we went to the patent office about some of the ideas we had, they said, oh, no, that's too predatory. We can't take advantage of the blind like that, so we can't patent them. I said, okay, so let's publish them. I said, well, we don't know if we want to give all those ideas away. So they waited for a long time. The report is out, and it's old, but it actually describes some of the things, like the reasons why a single cell doesn't work well for reading. Or if you're going to try to make a single cell read well, you have to move the Braille under the finger, not pop it up under the finger. And we developed some ball-bearing belts that did that well and other things. But I don't want to keep on that. That was a project by itself, but it got IBM interested in the technologies and seeing that there were some solutions. 1974, the first German Braille solenoid displays that had little Braille cell with a very small footprint that could actually, you could nest them together to even do a whole page if you wanted. They're very expensive, but they had the characteristic that you had to have your finger off the Braille when it's set up. You may remember them. That the Schoenherr sold them, the Micro Brailler, BD20, I think, and some Braille links. Lazy, when it was Maryland Computer Systems, sold them for a few months before they discovered the other major problem. Dirt killed them. A little bit of dirt, and it was just like having your finger on it. It wouldn't set up properly. They tried putting a film over it to keep the dirt out, but people just say, yuck, Braille, film over it, yuck. They'd pull the film off. A few months later, the thing would die from dirt. So Schoenherr Braille displays were cute. The design is clever. They didn't work very well. The Schoenherr did them on up into the 80s, did some calculators with them and things, but they weren't the real answer. Now, 1975, Debbie Speech Plus somewhere up here.
Flop.
The IBM what?
Speech Plus calculator.
The audio copy unit that they put on the Magpie machine.
Okay, oh, thank you. You actually use one?
I did.
Okay. One of the successes, I would say limited successes, was we handed that project off to Austin, Texas Typewriter Division. It was a talking typewriter. We had some things like a touch-sensitive audio strip across the top. They didn't take that. It was one where you could just slide your finger back and forth and it would talk wherever you touched. They didn't take all of that. They wanted to do it their own way. In fact, they started off with Braille that was three times higher than regular Braille and twice as wide, twice as tall front to back. And they were using that for Braille on every button and stuff, on the review button. And I said, that's not regular Braille. Oh, we do things bigger in Texas. In fact, they made it say, they weren't happy when I designed it originally to say blink in the prototype. Blink, blink, or, you know, I was saying blank, you know. But the Texans thought it was saying blink, you know. And so I said, blank. We finally changed it to space. You know, space, 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 space. But there were some problems with handing that off. They did put it on the memory typewriter, it's electric, and the mag card. They were big, huge units and expensive. They didn't sell very well, I'd say, but there were some people that use them. Thanks for asking about that. I just was trying to back away from too much IBM. Well, okay. 1975, the first microcomputers came on the market. I hate, again, using the term first, because whenever you do, somebody's going to pop up, well, what about mine? It was first. It was a little bit bigger. We'll come back to it. 1976, the Kurzweil Reader, the first one. It had a cloth-covered brick to hold a book down, and it was really a brick. You know how many of those ended up going through the glass plate when somebody dropped them? Too many. Yeah. But it read, and it worked pretty well. Compared to nothing, it was usable on a lot of stuff. Then 1977, well, we had gotten in, I was still with IBM, and we'd gotten IBM interested in doing this talking typewriter, and guys in Lagode, France stuck up their heads and thought, wait a minute, we got Braille based on an old IBM approach, which uses a rubber sheet. It was, actually, who knows the first paperless Braille display? Yeah. 1947, the Wheeler belt. It was a rubber belt that moved continuously, and it friction gripped metal pins in the belt. And a typist would type and punch a paper tape. The paper tape was fed into the unit. And so she could read back everything she had just typed from the paper tape and say, oh, darn, and go back and type it all over again. So reading after the fact, it didn't work very well for the application. But it made really nice Braille.
It was calculator.
That's the Speech Plus that Debbie was showing. We said that was 1975. Thank you. Okay. It's somewhere around here. I'm going to move a little bit here. And what IBM was looking at then was this really nice Braille display that hermetically sealed the dirt out by the rubber plate. And it was the first 80-cell Braille display I ever knew about. They were pushing that. So IBM decided they had to make a choice. They couldn't back two different technologies, speech and Braille. So they had a major human factors test at the human factors lab in IBM where they brought in 9 secretaries from around the country. People like Jerry Koons finagled his way in to see what we were doing. And everybody said, and this is the point I want to make, at the time, everybody was saying, well, I know I like Braille better because I've been using it all my life. I'm biased against audio. Because what was audio? Audio was 3 or 4 seconds of mucking around with a rewind button and play and rewind again, backing up, even with the dictaphone, right? It was hard to hear something over. You just want to hear that one word over, and you got to mess around and waste a lot of time. So audio was not fast response in most people's experience. What we'd done with our talking typewriter prototype that we were testing there before we handed it off to Houston, or Austin, Texas labs, was we made something that was fast response. I got the Votrax so it could just shut up on a dime. You hit a button and you had instant speech. That made audio something very different from Braille, and it made it very different from audio that people were used to. So we did put them in the human factors test, and surprisingly, at the end of a week working on each of the machines half the time, all of the secretaries they tested said, I don't know why I thought audio wouldn't be as good as Braille. I've been using audio even longer in my life. So. But it really was a different experience. Nowadays, people are so used to audio that they say, oh, people didn't think audio was cool. You know? But what most of us were that really worked with is a new good Braille and good audio said, the best thing is both of them. So moving, I'm going to jump on down here. Debbie, did you find the Speech Plus?
No.
It's in here somewhere. It could be packed in a corner somewhere. Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay. How am I doing on time?
You're doing good.
Okay. Okay. The 1977, another major event was...
I hate your computer.
Thank you. The mass marketing. See, he segues well sometimes. He behaves. The mass marketing of personal computers started. There was the 1977 West Coast Computer Fair, and everything was S100 computers there, almost. Now, that doesn't
IBM.
That doesn't mean the S100 computers. The S100 was the name of the type of bus. Developed after the Altair from Albuquerque. And I have to tell this one real quick thing. My brother was working at MITS, which was developed the Altair in Albuquerque in this. He was trying to get this one machine fully loaded with all 14 slots full of memory cards, 1K each. So it had 14K, and the power supply was going, and this other guy that worked there, Bill, was saying, wow, Gary, isn't this cool? I mean, we could put BASIC on here and a word processor and a printer, and we have a real computer. And they were just blown away by it. And so he even tried to talk my brother into going to business with him and move off to Washington to start up this little company named Microsoft. But my brother couldn't be bothered doing that. He didn't think it was a good opportunity. So I'm sorry, Gary, I didn't mean to tell that story, but it was, can't resist. So the MSI Altair S100s had been out there for a while before this, the 77 conference. But that was the time when everybody got to show their wares. And Debbie and I went to this, and we went on. There's one booth of these guys with some kind of different. It was shallow cards. They weren't big S100 cards. And I asked this guy, yeah, what is it? He said, well, it's not S100 compatible. I looked at him and said, my gosh, how do you expect to compete in this world if you're not S100 compatible? And this guy named Steve something just said, well, we think we've got an approach on the market that may work. I said, well, of course. Steve Jobs. It was Steve. I don't know which Steve it was, actually. It was one of them. It could have been Jobs or Wozniak, but I was an arrogant jerk there. I was so convinced S100 was a going thing, and they straightened me out. Not real soon. Okay, 1979, the major event in Access was the VersaRail. It sort of stuttered its way out. First units, we got 50 to the VA center, and some down in Houston started, the dots started going out and stuff, and we discovered there was a humidity problem that silver ions on the conductors would sort of make snail trails over the edge and short them out. 50 units from the VA all had come back and be replaced, and they stacked them up in the corner of my office because I was always accepting stuff people had thrown out. That pile stunk. I couldn't figure out why. I went through them and found one of them actually had been urinated on. So guys in the VA were a little bit angry, you know, about it. So, DSI did manage to straighten that problem out eventually and get the units going, and the rest of that is history. Okay, 1979 brought us to another interesting point. Duxbury was using, Joe Sullivan was, for the first time, was using some of those brand new microprocessor things that have been out for 2 years to run his Braille translation program based on DOCSIS. It was based on DOCSIS, which was developed at MITRE, John Gilday and some folks. Well, he got it working on the North Star and on OASIS and on a CPM machine. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, when I was at TSI, when this nerdy kind of guy from back east called up, and he was really pushing for my help, he wanted to get one of the first VersaRails he could get, and he was way down the queue, but he had this idea of putting it up to an Apple computer. And he said, can you help me get to Bliss to convince him that I could do TSI a lot of good if I could get it hooked up to an Apple computer? So December of 81, he finally got his wife's VersaRail, David Holliday, for Karen Navy. And he hooked it up and got it working with a VersaRail in December. And then in the spring, David finally got a car and used it to drive up to MIT and buy one of the old used MIT embossed prototypes, one of the 20 prototypes they made. Dragged it home. It didn't work. He got it working. I don't know when the fire you mentioned came out of it that Karen discovered. But oh, okay. So she broke it so David could buy a Jeep.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So in spring of 82, David got it working on the Apple, the MIT emboss. And that appears to be another landmark of the first time that a separate Braille embosser was run off of a microprocessor. And that really did start new things like the Cranmer Brailler, gave it a neat. Yeah, dunka, 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 yeah.
The Beetle was in MIT.
Yes, Vito, among other things, that vinyl disc recorder that I mentioned, Vito used it to get through college for taking notes, actually, and knew who to hand it off to when he was done.
State of New York gave everybody a gray autograph.
Hmm.
It was a gray autograph.
Oh, you thought it was Chris Gray's autograph, but no, no.
But instead of it's Art Humery as the head in terms of the center, so the linear speed.
The fidelity stayed the same, yeah. Okay. So now that brings us to 1989 was really when another major trip. What? Well, there's a reason for that. I'll come back in a second. But 1989 brought us to where the World Wide Web was really opening up information access. Doesn't mean we were all there with it, but we were wanting and drooling and stuff like that. But the reason I skipped all those years in there, from 82 to 89, 7 years, was at that time, 89, we were talking about the World Wide Web, actually. Opened access to the Internet for a lot of people. Yeah, it wasn't the start of the Internet, correct? Yeah, you're right about that. Okay, so what happened during that time period? Well, I call it the boring years, that we got various Braille note takers that were neat and useful, and, like the Braille and Speak and things. Those were all good years, but you guys all know about this stuff, so I shouldn't be bothering you with it. So the last 20 years, I kind of just thrown out. We're going to get there. Okay, yeah. Okay, I just wanted to finish these notes, okay? And then we'll make the rounds. Okay. So that finished sort of that chronology, the future, okay? I will come back to these things, okay? And we'll give everybody lots of time for feeling the things, okay? If you stop. I don't know what he just broke there. Okay, what's happening? Okay, we're getting, as I mentioned before, we went through this very dependence on humans and some animals and mechanical access tools, things like where we take the hands off of things, like take the face off of a clock and try not to take the hands off. Yeah. Debbie, can you hand me the Geiger counter? Oh, she cues so well, isn't this? This is why we're still married. Thank you. Some of those manual things that we developed were a surprise to me. In high school, I didn't have too many things. I did get eventually a Braille watch, but first off, I had to just take one of the clocks. I had a little travel alarm that has a cover that will slide up over it, so it doesn't really need the glass plate over the hands. So I took this thing and pulled the glass plate out of it. It was glow in the dark, but long before that, when I could still see, the hands had stopped glowing. So I just happened to bring along my Geiger counter. And recently I checked this clock out.
Now this is what I used to check for nuclear radiation and things.
This is my Geiger counter, my little pocket Geiger counter. And this thing is putting out about 11,000 RPM or counts per minute. And I was using this thing without washing my hands when I go to bed at night and suck my thumb or whatever.
Yeah,
that's what's wrong with me. I'm powered in the dark. Just to give any of you who are really paranoid about this, just to give you a sense, a lot of us have in our homes radiation materials. This is not part of the access stuff, except these things are at least accessible for being able to listen to them and hear the counts. But you can hook them up to a computer to make them accessible. And if you take them on an airplane, it can make the staff real nervous because the airplanes, you get up to 30,000 feet, and they're getting about 30 times the dose they get at sea level. Now, this radiation source here is from your smoke detector. It's the alpha source from your smoke detector. Another pretty strong one is the mantelpieces from Coleman lanterns.
Right.
Those they're strong. Welding rods. Some of you guys that may have been doing welding, welding rods have thorium in them, and that's actually an environmental hazard for people. So it goes here from right around here. It's about 14 counts per minute. Up at on an airplane, you get about 400 counts per minute. So. Yes, that was pretty deadly. Those are bad for cancer. So, sorry about the sidetrack here, but I just couldn't resist with my geeky tool. So, so some of those things we just made mechanical modifications. Maybe you filed a notch, in, you know, for every hour or whatever, or a meat thermometer that I just took the glass plate off and filed a couple of notches. I hope Debbie wouldn't see in it. And you can get access to some of those. But then we went electrical and electronic, and then digital integrated circuitries, microprocessors, now software. And I think what you're going to see is an awful lot of stuff will become more accessible through software. Peter's presentation makes a good example of that. And what's going to happen, though, next, the hardware. The hardware isn't keeping up with it as far as Braille. National Braille Press has started a project I'm putting a plug-in for called the Center for Braille Innovation. The Center for Braille Innovation has pulled together people like Dean Blasey and some others of us to really take a good look at what's necessary to bring down the cost of Braille by an order of magnitude. How about a note taker that fits in your pocket, is like a Braille light, 20-cell Braille light, fits in your pocket, and costs a tenth of the regular cost?
Yeah, but you know, one of the problems, at least for me, is I do everything one-handed.
Yep.
Braille very fast.
Yep.
I've got a cell phone that's PDA that talks.
Yep.
And I can either type on the QWERTY keyboard or I can do voice notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be honest with you, I did this for less than $600.
Yep.
And if you can't compete with that,
yep,
you're not going to make it.
Completely.
And it was more, the phone was $150.
I agree.
But the screen reader was $270.
Yep, I agree. A Braille product has to get down the couple hundred dollar price range.
Yeah.
Okay, but we think it's possible.
It's got to be something that's integrated, not some damn Bluetooth thing that I've got to sit here.
Yeah. Agreed. Okay, no argument here. Okay, guys like Dean Blasey, who've been through this before, and they did make products that did, you know, major work for this industry. Now he's semi-retired. He wants to really do something big with this. So we are looking at two areas. One is, how do you bring down the price of a note taker significantly? And we aren't announcing any products in this, of course. But the Braille display is so small that you can actually make a 20-cell display. In fact, I have a mock-up of one with a real Braille display in it that's smaller than by an inch on either side and front and back than the old Braille and Speak. So it's no taller than the Braille and Speak. So the technology is starting to get there as far as the size, but bringing down the price has been the real problem, because a little bit of inflation change has brought the price down a little bit, but they're still very darn expensive. So how are we going to do this? We've been starting to try to get the whole field to focus on research in Braille. In March, Dean and I are going to speak at the Electroactive Polymers Technology Conference to get researchers to focus on this. We've written articles for their newsletters, trying to help people focus. National Braille Press is getting a website up that will have my prior art listing, an attempt to list every tactile and Braille display technology that's been developed. Why? Same thing as those light probes. People have reinvented various kinds of Braille displays over and over. Several Grunewald Braillers, several Nightingale memory displays. A lot of things like that have been done. I think I've counted over 13 belt displays, like the Wheeler belt, and even a couple of them just like the Wheeler belt, the rubber belt that IBM did. So what we want to do is post those things. Another thing we didn't have was a spec for refreshable Braille. Nobody has a spec for it. How close should two lines be if you have more than one line of Braille? So we've worked with Judy Dixon and developed up a spec for that. So we're starting, coming soon, it's going to be some new resource materials at the National Braille Press for helping developers. At this EAP conference, we're going to be handing out free samples of Braille displays and Braille cells and piezoelectric reeds, because a lot of these researchers, first thing they wanted to do is get their hands on previous stuff to compare it. And by the way, anybody that's interested, I have with me Opticons and the guts of Opticons, the actual displays, if you want to feel the innards of it. I have VersaBraille, and I've got the guts of a VersaBraille display, the individual cells as well as the display, if you've never been inside one. And anybody that wants a memorial or souvenir Braille cell, I've got some of those to give away.
You got the 200 volts
UC. They do that. I take it off. I don't put it on. By the way, the brand new little Braille display I mentioned, that's the displays that can fit inside of something the size of a Braille and Squeak, those have the 200 volt supply already in the Braille display itself. So they're getting much nicer. Okay, why are we optimistic? Now, over the years, we've seen people promise new Braille display technologies, and that's driven by that bad economics that says to be able to get grants, you've got to go out and get people excited. And so you got to promise things that you really don't have. And, yeah, sort of, and trying to make it sound more exciting. And it's very often by people who haven't done their homework, haven't gone to what's going to be our prior art listening to see what's been done. And they're just excited about what they're doing in many cases. They start seeing dollar signs, think they're going to get rich in this field. And they aren't doing the math. So what they made lots of promises that we're all pretty bitter about, right? And so, but looking at the technologies, there's in particular one general field called electroactive polymers. Basically, you take something like real squishy silicone rubber and put electrodes on either side by smearing conductive grease on them or something, and put a voltage on it, and the stuff shrinks in that dimension and squirts out in the others. So it lengthens by factors of 3 in length. 300%. So the stuff can make some very significant changes in size, and it's gotten people in the robotics field very excited for the last 10 years, and they've sunk a lot of money in it. NASA for aerospace, and also for medical telerobots that go inside you, and a real tiny thing goes down a vein and then has a little robotic hand that manipulates, you know, cleans the blackout and stuff like that. So there are all these fields of research that could use these electroactive polymers or plastics that respond to electric fields for robotics and other kinds of applications. So they've sunk a lot of money in it, and the field is finally getting mature enough where they've searched it and straightened out the material science to where they can really start to make these things. They now have individual little actuators that can move a single pin that could go on the centers necessary to make a full-page braille display. And those will probably in a few years start replacing some of the piezoelectric displays we have where the big reeds come in like your fingers sticking out like swimming pool diving boards or cantilevers. So in the next couple of years, they are really, some people like Yang in Pennsylvania, who's working with Tiger folks, they're saying that they think they can start to bring the price down some by those, at least competitively now, and bring them down. What we're looking at is two things. One is to get the price of Braille down, but also improve the ability to make multi-line and full-page Braille displays. Now, things like talking cell phones and even cell phones with little Braille displays on them are cute and great for their application. There are many applications where having at least 4 lines or a whole page for graphics, for tables and things, really starts to become something different from a little short display. And this project is something a couple of decades ago, I decided to use this term at a conference one time, referred to it as the quest for the holy Braille. It is that difficult. I don't want anybody would become religiously sensitive about that to get upset with me. It's not meant sacrilegiously. But it's caught on. We've had about a dozen articles recently because of the stuff we've been publishing from NBP to get workers on the field. Popular Science jumps right on. Quest for the Holy Braille. And tomorrow morning, after Debbie and I get home tonight and unpack and then repack our bags, Debbie and I are off to China to the World Braille Forum, where we're presenting this MVP project. They wanted to title it The Quest for the Holy Braille. Chinese people don't know what the Holy Grail is, usually. So we decided not to use that title. So we are working, though, to get people jazzed up and to get focused on Braille, because we think that the material science technology, these special plastics, are starting to get to where they can work. They're making, in the laboratory, single cells and multiple cells now that could make these cells, these displays. And an example is, in Japan, they made something that's a rubber sheet of silicone with the circuitry, actually electrical circuits, printed on it. The way they print some of the large displays now, that they could actually print on this rubber sheet. And it works. He's been able to produce Braille with it.
Well,
yes?
One of the things also that you might want to think about, I don't really care about this, but there are blind broadcasters who care about the noise of...
Absolutely.
The
yeah.
Display.
Yeah, some of the display technologies people have developed in the past are things like this Wheeler belt. They go... a few years ago, somebody in Japan actually did one where instead of the rubber belt, it was cloth that was gripping the pins. It only took a half a minute to set up, and it was noisy as heck because the stepper motors, just like old printers. So absolutely, you're right. This stuff, electroactive polymer stuff, can be just silent, completely silent. It had an interesting side effect is you could roll the thing up like a roll-up keyboard, actually. Not that that's very important, but, you know. Now, he was about half there on the height of the Braille dots, half there on the force, and about half there as far as response time. It'd take a couple of seconds, 2 seconds, second half to 2 seconds to set up. It really should be half a second or less. More like we'd love to see tenth of a second. And it wasn't raising the dot high enough. But that for an early attempt was pretty darn good. And just like your large liquid crystal displays where they print circuitry on them, if you can start printing that stuff on there as all one mass process, you don't have people wiring little pins and all the individual hand elements that have to go into a current braille display and make it expensive. So that technology, we think, really will eventually bring about not only larger braille displays like multiple lines and full page, but much less expensive. Not next year, not the year after, you know, but we think the technologies are getting there and we need to bring focus to it. And so we're trying to bring focus and tell these researchers exactly the kinds of comments you made just now. These things can't be noisy. You know, they have to respond not in 30 seconds, but in under a second. The power has to be reasonable. We have had some displays like one using wax. You know, imagine a printed circuit board with holes drilled all over it and you fill them with wax and seal the bottom, run electrical current through the wax by putting graphite in the wax, and you can heat the wax up, sure. You can heat it up, and it'll expand just like candles do. It'll expand and poke up out of the hole. You have to have some way to feel it without rubbing the wax off. But they didn't sit down and do a power calculation. Yeah, if you get that power in there without popping the circuit breaker, you can't do it on batteries, but if you can do it, how do you get it out? Major big fans and the cooling unit, you know, they never sat down to do the math to say, oh, you can't put that much power in them because you can't get it back out. So we've decided that our Center for Braille Innovation at National Braille Press team, we're becoming real experts in how not to make Braille display. That puts it positively. But we really do think that there's some good to be done from that. So we're trying to get people organized. We're trying to share technologies like where we have documentation and resources. Also, show them things like Braille displays. We're looking for those early German Braille displays, some samples of those. If anybody has some of those they know about, they want to donate. We can form an archive at National Braille Press. So we're trying to bring together all these researchers. We appreciate anybody's help in pointing people at the National Braille Press. That, we think, is where the technology is going to go. And as I said earlier, I don't think audio is the perfect technology. I don't think Braille is the perfect technology. I think the combination is the best thing for if you can. Some people can make do with audio only. I've done a lot of that in my life. We really think that it's exciting, finally, that we cynical old guys think that we're finally going to get some real drop in the price and improvement in the capabilities of Braille. Okay, now, I'm going to open it up to let everybody come up. I'm going to explain real briefly what is here, so you can ask about it if you don't see it. I guess we could do that on the mic. Where did the mic go? Okay. Debbie's asked me to donate. For those of you who won't come up because you're sensible, I have synthesizers here, several of them, like the old Votrax. If I can figure out where the button is. The volume.
They won't.
I have some of the different synthesizers, like what did you say over there?
Votrax.
I have an adapter up here, of course. Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Tech Talk Express is running. Battery okay.
Amazing. And adapter.
Hello, adapter.
Adapter system. Ready.
And I have an Apple computer up here. It's an Apple 2E with the Echo Speech synthesizer on it.
Asset ready. Asset ready.
I didn't bring any of the cards. I didn't think people would be so excited. I have Sams and Crickets and Echo cards.
How about the mocking board?
Now, thank you for bringing up to that. Yeah, we have mounting board in the Apple here, I think. The Apple derailed me. Sorry. Here's the accent. Okay, the point is, I ended up with all the leftover stock from the accent folks, AI, when they went out of business, AICOM. So I have about two dozen accent boards. Those are the standalone boards that just need a 12-volt supply, either the PC bus or some other ways. Anybody who wants one can have two for free. Two, so you have a backup, okay? If you have people using Linux systems or others where they want an external audio synthesizer, or you have some application you want to put speech with text-to-speech built in, you're welcome to these things. So they're free. If you have some device that needs the SSI chip, the old Votrax speech chip has gone bad, these would be a handy source for that. So let's see. I have a Votrax which is not cooperating right now.
be him.
Do you have the switch app in the back?
Version 3.T.
No.
Full track ready.
The right trick on. Is hitting it. Like the repairman that comes in and
there you go.
Takes a big old hammer.
Hit the TV on the side.
Kicks it and then charges the person for the repair. And then for kicking it? He said, no, for knowing where to kick it. So this is your Votrax PSS. It's like
version 3.T. Full track ready.
It's like a big old long salami. The Apple here uses the Echo card. It's not plugged in. Don't ask me to. But we could if you want. As I said, we have braille cells we can show you here. Debbie's done a nice job of arraying everything out. Please don't anybody walk off with anything. If there's something you really want, talk to me. And we may do something. Okay?
Or talk to me.
Talk to me. No? Talk to me, please.
Do you actually have a working option?
Yep, there's a working Opticon up here. I also have cameras. I have cameras for the Opticon. There's a CRT lens, and I have one of the typewriter lenses here, if you want to see those. Oh, okay. My name is Noel, N-O-E-L, like Christmas, Runyan, R-U-N-Y-A-N. It's Noel at, my email address is Noel at Personal Data Systems, all one word, .com. It's Noel at personaldatasystems.com. I will even give you my phone number, 408-866-1126. So let me give a quick rundown of some of the things that we have up here. We have these synthesizers we mentioned, the Apple, a Brandon Slate, if you're familiar with that. The Brandon Slate was like the Taylor Slate. It has 16 by 16 square holes in it, and you stick little pegs in it. And the pegs in this case are actually little braille dice. And for the numbers.
I like this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll keep the. I will show you one. Actually, I'm keeping the rest of them.
I actually learned arithmetic up there.
We have a Banks brailler up here. We have an abacus, slide rule. I have a Monroe calculator here, which is the heaviest thing up here down at the end of the table, which is a mechanical calculator with a. Roger, did you want to see it? It's a mechanical calculator, the Monroe, in which you heard those old calculators. That's one of those.
Especially depressed divide.
If you do subtract and add at the same time, it goes ka-chunk and freezes up. What they did was, again, took out the glass covering and put braille on the discs and turn inside that represent the numbers. So you can actually feel in the window the braille display on.
Just to show how old I am, that was what the psychology department asked me.
Yeah, well, that's what I used to call it, so don't beat me on that. Oh, yeah, okay. We won't talk about ages. Okay, there's a Manx Braille here. Okay. Are there questions, folks? You've been very patient while I ran through this. Okay. Catherine Thomas and some others do have a listserv on the Opticon. Jim Bliss is on and others. He's asking what the status of the Opticon is. There are the two Opticon versions so far. They're talking about trying to do an Opticon 3. Opticon 3, there are a couple of significant things. One is to increase the resolution on the display, because going to the Opticon 2 was a mistake. It's because the Japanese designed that and they didn't have the descenders for it. So they didn't think they needed it. And Bliss didn't realize how big a deal that was when he just agreed to pick up the Opticon 2 design the Japanese did. So it would have a bigger display than the old Opticon in terms of more dots, better camera. One of the significant things I want to see on it is sine wave instead of square wave. Sine wave, it would just hum very quietly. And instead of... Lazy Engineering did some testing on it and found they could take an old Opticon and modify it and actually put sine wave hum instead of on it. So,
let me see your pen.
What?
Pen.
Sorry, one second. There's your question in the back, Senator.
Why did they come in the first place? What was the purpose?
Oh, well, it turns out that if you've just got your finger sitting on tactile dots, you cannot feel them very well. You get ghost images. That's why a single-cell solenoid doesn't work very well. If you drop the pin out, you get ghost images.
No.
If you vibrate it at about 250 hertz, there's another tactile sense that comes into play, and you can feel it better. So vibrating the Opticon at 250 hertz gives you a better tactile sensitivity than if you just lifted the dots up and kept them up. Yeah. Well, the reason it did square wave was their initial human factors testing was flawed. They showed it to people and said, "Do you like this?" They said, "Oh yeah, this is cool." And they said, "And the noise isn't too annoying?" "Oh no."
And they
Yeah. When they got it to where they already committed to getting the chips made and stuff, that's when some people started saying, by the way, can you make it quiet? And they said, well, we could have, but it's too late now. We've already committed. You know? We don't have another $1 million to throw down the drain. So, yeah. Could you hold your question 1 second? I'll finish Opticon. So there are efforts to try to make a better Opticon, and the electroactive polymers people at Stanford and others are actually working on making a new tactile display that could be compact and work better than the old piezo type. I have to have piezo crystals up here with me if anybody wants to see them from Opticon. But so they are working. It's right now. It's not a real active effort. It's an underway thinking stage. Okay, your question?
Do we know if they're planning on reentering?
No. It's right now. It's a pipe dream. It's not an active project. Okay. I've talked to people like Jim Bliss that are involved in it, and Lavin Fernando just worked for TSI. An engineer. They're thinking about it. They've got the SRI people stirred up. We're trying to get the electroactive polymers people not just working towards Braille, but also tactile displays for the Opticon and other things.
Yes, I think tactile graphics is a real thing.
Yeah.
Having interactive tactile graphics would be a groove.
Yeah. Good feelings. Okay. So it's not about to happen next year or the year after. It's probably, my guess is it might be 5 years or 4 years or something, if it happens. Okay. Sorry. I don't mean to be negative about it. It's just one of the things I told Bliss was that unless they can make it a single-handed Opticon, they shouldn't bother. Now, some of you, you're well aware that you move the camera with one hand and have the tactile ray on your other hand. TSI actually made a kludged up little experiment where they sort of taped a tactile ray on top of a camera and had somebody read with it. So they were using it all with one hand, and they doubled their reading speed. Why? Because the information doesn't have to go across your brain from one side to the other to integrate to form the image. Yeah. So put the camera and the tactile display on the same hand, and the Opticon will be much easier to use. Not as demanding and not as fatiguing, but it'll go faster.
How would it work with Playboy?
Better.
Okay.
The line drawings in Playboy are okay, maybe. Sorry.
You tried it, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And here's the old abacus.
Okay, other questions? Thank you. These are good questions.
Oh, yeah, we remember playing Jesus.
Come on up and check these things out. I was saying we have the calculators, both electronic. We've got the slide rules, some of the other math aids.
Oh,
this is the Apple?
Yep, Apple II.
Actually, Peter Conestani probably ran away, but he told me just a few days ago, Peter said he saw on eBay an Apple IIe like this sold for $17,000.
What?
Yeah? Put it up on eBay.
Why would someone pay $17,000?
Well, it was probably, it might have been a particular one of collector's value. I had a friend who actually sold an Apple I to Apple Computers in the early days because they had never kept one for their own museum.
Do you remember the big discs that used to go in these things?
Yes, I do.
Floppies?
Yeah, they were floppy.
Yeah,
they were
floppy.
This Apple uses the Echo board internally and has a little signature speaker box
for the best thing
the audio output.
Everything I wanted.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Different sizes still worked.
The speech output on the Apples wasn't a whole lot of good until the Razor Computing came out with their Braille Edit. And David designed that not just to be a translation tool, but a whole access tool that could really it worked as a specific application instead of a generic screen reader. Anybody that wants braille cells for souvenirs, what's my offer? I've got different kinds of braille cells here too. Telesensory cells. You can see the braille cells have gone down almost half in height.
I want a braille L.
Yep, the real
Really? Oh, I know. Really? Anything.
This is one of the Seattle things along. It's a team. And now, TSI had the Navigator product, you may remember, as a Braille display that you put a laptop on top of. They got into production of those, and the Braille cells went south. It turns out that the supplier of the PZ Electric reeds in Japan suddenly lost their ability to make them right. And they couldn't make them for almost a year. TSI almost went out of business. Ended up suing them for $2 million and settling. For not being able to supply them. Meanwhile, TSI had to have something, so they bought Tiemann cells from Europe, like these thin ones I just showed you. The long, thin Tiemann cells were shoehorned into the Navigator rail display to make it work. These cells?
Yeah,
rail cells. Yeah, sure. There are different kinds there. Did you see?
Yeah.
There are the... I have Braille cells that are from the I have Braille cells that are from Super Braille. Braille cells almost the same. They're made by United Braille that are made for the Braille Light. Braille Light 20 cells. Those are the smallest cells of these Braille Light 20s.
Mr. Runyon?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your time, for showing up today, bringing all these toys. I hope you realize that I just gained a great deal of arthritis just by touching some of this stuff because it's so old.
That was revolting.
I'm sorry.